Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the movie geeks are reliving the summer of 1983 with special guests including John Badham, a director who owned the summer with the mega hits War Games and Blue Thunder, Dee Wallace, who gave an indelible performance in the brutal and unrelenting film Cujo, and Tom Holland, whose fruitful career got a jump start when he penned Norman Bates' return to the big screen after a 23-year absence for Psycho 2. And from Return of the Jedi and Risky Business to Trading Places and Fanny and Alexander, acclaimed film critic Glenn Kinney will join us for a roundtable discussion on the remainder of the films that filled that glorious summer 25 years ago. Get ready for a ton of movie geek fun. It's Movie Geeks United, coming up next.
Shall we play a game?
I'm going to ask you that.
How about global thermonuclear war?
Fine.
War Games. Roy Scheider is Frank Murphy, a lone wolf.
Freeze!
Who's about to become a guinea pig.
I thought it was illegal to arm police helicopters.
Well, that would depend on the circumstances, wouldn't it?
Columbia Pictures presents Blue Thunder.
Nothing that lives in the imagination is more frightening than the terror that lives in Castle Rock, Maine. Now there's a new name for terror. Cujo.
In 1960, motion picture history was made. It's 22 years later. And Norman Bates is coming home.
United, the summer of 1983. This is a special show I know a great many people out there have been waiting for. This is going to be a lot of fun. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening. And I'm joined by fellow movie geek hosts, Jerry and Aaron. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
What's up? What's up?
Did you just curse on the air, Jamie?
What's that?
Did you just curse on the air? I'm shocked. I'm really just
shocked. I didn't.
I think you did. That's all right. I mean, you know.
Oh, I started out the program by cursing. I didn't think I cursed. I'm so sorry. I need to censor myself from here on out. I'm just
okay.
So excited. I mean, this.
I know. We all are.
That we're going to be waxing nostalgic about, you know, a time in movies that meant a lot to us as kids, you know. And
yeah.
I know a lot of our listeners out there feel the same way. I want to introduce, just from the very beginning here, you heard the guests that are going to be on tonight at the very beginning there. We have a great guest lineup. We're also going to be welcoming Keith Ulick at the end of the show. He's a contributor and editor for The House Next Door, a great blog on films. And they've been supporting this concept, the summer of 1983, by writing some essays of their own on certain jewels that came out that summer. it's some very funny, very enlightening stuff that'll really take you back.
Yeah,
so,
great stuff.
Yeah, I recommend going to housenextdooronline.com and read some of those essays that have appeared in the past 3 days. They're really good stuff out there. So join us in the chat room. You can just click the chat available icon on the upper right-hand side of the screen. That'll take you directly to our chat room, and you can converse with other movie fans. It's a lot of fun in there. And you can also call in with any questions you might have of our guests, 718-508-9477. And we got a lot of great content tonight. We're just waiting for our first guest to call in, Mr. Badham, and a tremendous honor because he's calling us from the set of a TV show he's directing called
Correct.
Psych.
He was a great interview the first time we had him on. That was a lot of fun.
He really was.
Great interview.
He really was. We interviewed him back in October about his book. And you can actually see the cover of his book on our page there. I'll be in my trailer. You can click on that. It'll take you directly to Amazon where you can purchase it. And it's one of the great books I've ever read on the craft of film directing and dealing with different, potentially volcanic personalities on a film set, which are usually the actors.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about all this?
What's that?
The both of these, Blue Thunder is the very first movie I rented on VHS. First film. And then War Games was the second. I got them like the same weekend because I wanted to watch War Games again. I'd never seen Blue Thunder. And I was just like, it's a great double feature.
What's funny about Blue Thunder is that I just saw this old special Siskel and Ebert episode from like late 83, early 84. And they were going down the video explosion. And so they went through the top 10 selling video cassettes at the moment. And Blue Thunder was like in the top five. It was one of the first really big selling VHS tapes. And this is back when, you know, tapes weren't selling for $25. You know, this was still when, you know, back when tapes were like $80 and VHS players were still in the high end market. So Blue Thunder was one of the first big sellers on VHS. So I mean, it's actually now a more underrated film, but it's quite a good film. Very good use of widescreen and of practical effects and, you know, models, some terrific night rear projection photography, and then some practical, you know, live photography of helicopters. The editing is really, really smooth. You could see it now if they were to make it now, they'd probably do a lot faster, a lot of quick cutting, and make the helicopters move a little smoother, when kind of that herky-jerkiness really gives it some authenticity. So.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I revisited these films this weekend. And you know how it goes. When you're particularly taken by a film in your childhood, you could watch it 20 years later and say, man, where was I coming from back then?
Yeah.
You know, who was I back then? War Games undoubtedly holds up.
Oh, it holds up. It's actually better. I think it's actually kind of more frightening as each, you know, decade goes on. There's something really, you know, plausible there.
Yeah. And Blue Thunder, you're just taken aback how damn exciting it is.
Yeah,
it works like gangbusters still.
Mm-hmm. A precursor to Homeland Security and surveillance, really. I mean, you want to get kind of a little far fetched, but there is seeds of that there, and also, but it's also fun to see what were the tropes back then in movies, and you know, back in the early '80s and you know, late '70s, we talked about this with, you know, obviously, First Blood is an obvious example, but it seemed for like about 3-4 years you couldn't have any type of adult, lead character in an action movie who didn't at some point, we found out, he was a Vietnam hero, did two tours in Nam.
Right.
And so they always had to, and that was like a shorthand to tell you that the character was kind of edgy, if you will. And so, it's kind of fun seeing these tropes back then. I wonder if we're going to get that for, you know, in 5 years, we're going to get that from Iraq. Soldiers. We're starting to slowly see that.
You are starting to see that in movies, that the characters are Iraq war vets or Afghanistan or the war on terror. You are slowly starting to see that.
Yeah. Well, from the very beginning, I mean, they said about Blue Thunder that this is really a statement about the Big Brother, and it was no irony that it came out a year before 1984, which was on everyone's mind before they devised the idea.
I remember that madness of 1984. It was crazy.
I'm going to refresh my switchboard just in case. I don't want to miss his call.
Right.
So he should be calling in. Like I said, he's on the set, so there's no telling. It's so unpredictable.
Live
when he
radio.
Can get away from, yeah, when he can get away. Yeah, live radio and live film shootings.
Yeah.
There you go.
And also War Games is also kind of a Big Brother scenario. Obviously, I don't think this was we know now that it was actually, I guess, a coincidence that Badham got onto both of these films and they came out at the same time, but there was something in the air that both films, Blue Thunder and War Games, were very trying to deal with kind of the Big Brother 1984 approaching in kind of a pop summer movie sensibility, and they did it quite well.
Yeah. And actually, both films, I mean, at the heart of both films, I mean, essentially they both speak to advanced technology and how that can be dangerous in the wrong hands.
The misuse of that technology.
Yeah.
And also, like you're talking about surveillance, that's something that's really never gone away. There's always been this paranoia about the government and the surveillance issues. That's never gone away. And that's what makes War Games is just so, even by today's standards, you're right, Jamie, it holds up surprisingly well. I mean, it gets better, I think, actually.
Yeah.
I really do with each viewing.
Yeah, and it's one of those films that, you know, it's a little antiquated, and, you know, they're using, I don't know for sure, but Commodore computer system.
Yeah, it's
kind of
antiquated.
But it's one of those things where it doesn't matter.
It's not the tool or whatever. It's the thing. But I will say this, is there one scene that always, especially while I was in school or college, you know, the scene where he changes his grades. I've always loved that. I wanted to always do that so badly.
Oh, that's every kid's dream.
Yeah, I wish that was just, to me, incredible.
Yeah,
but, and also,
especially seeing the tricks that I tried, I always got caught at them.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It just seemed that the thing about War Games, even though some of the technology is antiquated, but the basic nature of the technology has just been improved upon. There's no internet in War Games, but he is using
right.
a phone to connect with other computers.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a, you know, that's, I mean, it's an early version of dial-up, basically, you know.
Right.
So that is something, you know, it's still not so out of date that we don't understand what's going on.
Well, it's just the essential, and this is what's so great about it. This is what was so great about Matthew Broderick, too. It must have been difficult to, or maybe they knew Matthew Broderick from the start and they made it easy. But conceptually, it's a difficult part to cast because you're dealing with a character who is at once brilliant,
mm-hmm.
and yet so naive,
right?
You know, innocently so, you know, and so he's just charming in that movie, and it really takes you back to when Broderick was doing, you know, the Ferris Bueller, you know,
mm-hmm.
he did that several years later, but that really charming just command that he had.
Also, but Biloxi Blues, he was, you know, he made a lot of things
yeah.
back then
yeah.
that you were just that he played those characters wonderfully.
But it's the essential story of a kid like that entering this adventure, and the world could be eradicated by nuclear war as a result of what he does.
Yeah,
I mean that story is gangbusters. I mean you can't go wrong with that story.
No, you can't.
And here we're really getting into the two things that are going on in movies. One is the high influence of video games in both the visuals and the storytelling. A year earlier we had Tron, and then we have War Games, and then the following year. We get in the summer of 84, we get Last Starfighter and Cloak and Dagger.
Right.
And the other thing we're getting into, the other trend is that we're getting in the 80s a real youth-oriented kind of genre, really. Up, you know, all through the 70s, you know the stars and the movies, they were adults. They were in their 30s, be it De Niro, Pacino, but we're getting back to a youth-oriented and high-tech oriented filmmaking. There are youth-oriented films in the 70s, but they were real cheapies, and they were into drive-ins, and they were really disposable. But now, you know, the youth market is really coming into its own in the 80s. Not only Matthew Broderick with War Games, but also later in the summer, Risky Business with Tom Cruise.
That's right.
You know, and Sean Penn a summer earlier with Fast Times.
Fast Times, right.
And so you're really getting, and it's, you know, it's 25 years later, and we have yet to step away from that. It's all become youth culture
mm-hmm.
Since the early 80s. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's another discussion, but, you know, we're really seeing a transition in the summer of 83. In summer of 84, you know, if we're still on the air next year, you know, that's the summer of MTV finally penetrating Hollywood. And we'll really get in, you know.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, good. Very interesting choice of words there. But you see that the youth, as you bring up a good point, yeah, it is around that time that the youth become, and it hasn't let up either. It's been a constant criticism because, as you know, the movie-going audience is actually getting older,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to want to start to see films geared, you know, towards their age group. So that's going to be an interesting seismic shift.
Well, and we're starting to get there, but there's still some would say pander to the youth audience. An interesting film to look at, you know, out of just off the top of my head, is actually a movie like Juno,
mm-hmm.
which was marketed to the youth, but the people who grew up in the 80s who are now parents, that's a film that they gravitated towards also.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's an example of crossover.
We did
crossover appeal. And so we're getting this youth thing. What is happening though is there's a separation between high-end, I guess you could say, youth-oriented films, and then stuff that we're still getting these quickies. I mean, War Games, it has a teenager as its hero, but it is one of those films that went across the board. And same thing with E.T. That's
mm-hmm.
the ultimate, you know, kids film, but,
right.
you know, across the board. And
but that just appealed to everyone, Aaron.
Yeah.
That touched everyone.
Yeah, that's what we're getting. But, you know, there's some films that, you know, they could stay in their niche, be it like, you know, the horror film or the more juvenile sex comedies at that point.
Right.
So it was Hollywood was just throwing a lot of youth culture stuff at the wall. So it's kind of interesting the way that panned out in these early 80s
mm-hmm.
years. So.
Yeah, I mean, like, because they definitely still dominate the scene to a large degree. It was a summer of great films that'll live on forever, and it was a summer also of turkeys. But at the same time, you look back at some of the turkeys and with such reverence, because it's like childhood. It's like an innocence that you bring with it.
Because it's so much better than the turkeys of today.
And also, we're also seeing the end of a generation of moviegoers in that. Represented by the final Star Wars film coming out. So if you were, you know, 13 when the first Star Wars came out in 77, it's now 6 years later, so you're now 19 going on 20.
Mm-hmm.
So you've gone through a massive personality change, if you will, in maturation.
What
so
about
that,
if you go 6 to 12?
I think our first guest is on the line.
Okay, great.
So let's get this started and see how quickly we can do this now. A look back at the movie landscape from 25 years ago is unimaginable without the inclusion of our first guest tonight. Director John Badham had already entered the pop culture consciousness with his stellar work on Saturday Night Fever, but during the summer of 83, as we've been attesting to on the show so far, he delivered an unprecedented 1-2 punch with a duo of blockbusters, Blue Thunder, which opened on May 13th of that year, starred Roy Scheider as a renegade cop who uncovers mischievous motives behind the crafting of a state-of-the-art aircraft, and opening a mere 3 weeks later on June 3rd was War Games, the story of a brilliant young computer hacker who inadvertently cripples the nation to the brink of nuclear war. When viewed today, both films are still sensationally entertaining and contain valuable insights into the potential dangers of new technologies, especially when operated in the wrong hands. Mr. Badham has built a remarkable career directing landmark films and television series, and he's even written one of my favorite books on the craft of film directing titled I'll Be in My Trailer, The Creative Wars Between Directors and Actors. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the show a tremendous talent and a great friend to our show, Mr. John Badham. Let me bring him up here, if I can unmute his line. Mr. Badham, are you with us?
I sure am, and my apologies for coming in late.
No, quite
all right. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for asking me to come back.
Oh, it's a great honor. You know, we did last year, and we constantly get asked this. We did about 180 interviews last year. And we get asked, what is your favorite? And you are right there at the top, my friend. That was just a delightful conversation
so
we had.
Thank you.
And I couldn't wait to bring you back on. You're on location. You're shooting an episode of Psych. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. It's doing, you know, essentially the Evel Knievel story from the point of view of Psych, which is a wonderful combination of, you know, craziness and silliness and great action and motorcycle jumps and the phenomenal comedy that James Roday and Dooley Hill do.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We talked about this last time you were on. You know, obviously, your feature film career is fantastic, and you have several projects in the works to return to feature films, but you're also very active in television directing. Is there a dream show out there that you'd love to get your hands on and direct?
That are current shows. Well,
yes,
I'm still annoyed that I never got to do a Deadwood. That was always.
I'm sure that must be.
A great treat to, you know, to have done that. That was so much fun. The reality, the gritty reality of it. And you looked at it and you said, I've never seen the West like this, but by golly, I think this is the way it was.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was really this raw and nasty and, you know, feral and medieval and everything.
That would have been a dream. Yeah. So let's talk about the summer of 1983.
Sure.
This was a huge time for you. And first of all, I want to know, how did it come about that you had two films open within a month of each other that summer?
It was completely an accidental, unintentional kind of thing. I mean, you couldn't plan something like that. And Blue Thunder had finished plenty of time earlier and just took a long time for the editing and so on, and they had it set for, I think, Christmas time of the year before, and then they decided, no, it's really more of a summer picture, so they moved it up to the summer. In the meantime, War Games came along, and as we're in the middle of mixing sound for Blue Thunder, which was a huge job, the sound for that picture, they had decided they wanted to replace the director on War Games, who was going in a direction they didn't care for, and I get this frantic call, can you come over and start like now?
Wow.
And I went over and talked to them, and they said, how quick can you start? I said, well, I can go down there and start shooting right now, only it'll be crappy. I've read the script one time. I don't have an idea of the tone. I just know that there's a fabulous story here and something really terrific. While my agent negotiated with their producer, I'm sitting at home frantically trying to do it. And they said, okay, now you can have a week to prepare. We'll shut our company down for a week while you prepare. And about 3 days later, they've just twisted my arm and make me start shooting.
Wow.
So we were shooting and then frantically putting it together. And next thing you know, we're out there 3 weeks after Blue Thunder.
So War Games had pretty much been, everything had been established by the time you got on board.
The art direction was in place and it had been really nicely prepared, and they'd done a terrific job, and I replaced a couple of cast members that weren't quite working out to everybody's satisfaction, and changed a few locations and reshot a couple of things, and basically we were now pressing forward at lightning speed.
Yeah. Did it strike you at the time how thematically, how similar these two films were? Because I'm thinking of the technological aspect of it, and you know, obviously Big Brother plays a big part. Did that strike
you? Oh, absolutely.
You, that
well, we were very aware of 1984, you know, the novel 1984 in Blue Thunder. And how that played a part, and of course the pervasiveness of computers was, you know, beginning to come clear to, you know, almost anybody who had the IQ of a cucumber or above. You could tell that you know, we were already being, you know, our lives were being taken over by computers. Mm. And now we are today at the point where if, you know, a lot of computers shut down, we are in terrible, terrible trouble.
That's just it. Yeah, and it was right there. It was right there in War Games. I mean, 25 years ago. And what's amazing to me is, like so many of your films, I mean, Saturday Night Fever is the prime example that we discussed last time you were on. These movies just thrive. They don't lose anything as the years go by.
That's true.
Yeah, they're just still incredibly vivid and entertaining. Are you surprised that these films have lived as long as they have?
Well, frankly, no, because they have. Probably what attracted me to them in the first place was the substance of the story, that there was something there more than a bunch of jokes or a bunch of stunts. Mm-hmm. And that there was something underneath. I mean, when you go underneath Saturday Night Fever, you find a really powerful story of a young guy trying to find a place for himself in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And though we remember the music and we remember the dancing the most, when you go back to it, you go, oh my gosh, there is this really strong story, and that's why all those imitations of it just didn't work. Same thing with War Games. You know, you think, oh, we got a kid, a bright kid with a computer, evil genius, and it'll be fine. But there's a lot to be said there about, isn't war an interesting game? The only solution, the only winning move is not to play.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is this subtly stuck in little statement from the computer at the end. It's great insight.
It's a great lesson that we can learn today, too.
That we continue to ignore. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, let's start a war in Iraq. Yeah, that'll be fun. Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. And now we can't get out of it.
You know, I want to ask you, get into Blue Thunder just a little bit, but I saw that you took War Games to Cannes. Is that correct? What was behind that decision?
And tell me
about that
experience. That was MGM being, thrilled with the movie and saying, well, let's not enter it into competition in Cannes, but let's send it over to them. And they said, when they saw it, they said, please come and play it as our closing film on closing night. So that's what we did, which was a great thrill for me. And much better to play it out of competition, because that way I wasn't nervous, because it was nervous enough just to play it out of competition.
Yeah, that's true. Aaron has a question for you. He's one of our co-hosts.
Yes, Aaron. I'm sorry.
No, I guess that summer you were like the Indiana Jones movie of that summer.
That's right. Yeah, there had been Indiana Jones and one other movie that Stephen had done before, where he had two going at the same time.
Right, right.
What I'm curious is, because I'm a big Blue Thunder fan, is that it seems to me that if it was done today, that it would all be smoothed out with the CGI and quick edits and so forth. But I just seen the film again a couple of nights ago. I really just looking at it in a kind of objective way and not getting too nostalgic, I really did like kind of the herky jerkiness and kind of the practicality of these effects. And I was wondering, what's your take on that? Like, if someone was to do a Blue Thunder today, I mean, would you prefer, if you were given that story today, would you want to try to mix the practical with the CGI, or do you feel that maybe CGI would allow you to do stuff you couldn't do then?
Well, I mean, what we had at the time was, sort of an intermediate step between old-fashioned mat shots and what we're starting to be, the kind of motion control that was developed for Star Wars, what they were doing for the original Star Wars. So we could do things that, couldn't have been done 10 years before, but, obviously the leaps and bounds have been made since then. But the whole approach to the movie was to try to film it in as documentary a style as we could, for something that was very tightly scripted, but to try to get that a rough edge to it, and make it feel like there was a reality to it, that this was not stuff we were making up.
It dawned on me. I didn't clock it, but I was actually kind of startled. I'd forgotten really the last 30 minutes of the film is one long action sequence, which is pretty spectacular and pretty amazing in that you were able to sustain the suspense for a good 30, the last 30 minutes of the film is really one long action sequence that goes up and down.
It's fantastically exciting. It really is.
Yeah, it's great. It's great fun, too, because there was so much happening there and so many different incidents,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the silliness of the barbecue shack blowing chickens all over the place to, you know, a helicopter to F-16 jets shooting rockets into the Arco Towers.
Right.
What's that, Jerry? Go ahead.
I just had a thing. I wanted to say something about War Games since we have Mr. Batom on the phone. When I saw that film in the theaters, and, you know, that's the height of the Reagan era, Cold War, you know, there were times there during that period that we were very scared of nuclear war. I was.
Mm-hmm.
I made no bones about that. And I thought your film was actually kind of therapy almost to deal with it.
At that age, absolutely.
No, and I have to say, but one of my friends told me, oh, they blow up the world and don't go see it. Like, he was teasing me. It's like, they blow up the world. You'll be depressed for years. Don't go see it. I went to go see it. I was like, they didn't blow up the world. Why are you telling me this? But I really thought that film really was really well done. It was, and it made you kind of less scared, if anything.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. That's interesting that you take that. Certainly, you know, I worry about it more today.
Oh, trust me, it is. It's very worrying.
That's just that these issues are still so prevalent today that were established in these films 25 years ago. That's what's so incredible about these films, how they endure. We're talking about the summer of 1983, some of our most cherished moments in films, and Ms. Dee Wallace is on the line, and we're going to get to her in just one second. We're speaking to Mr. John Batom about Blue Thunder and War Games. Now, Blue Thunder had to have been a difficult, daunting shoot, simply because you had to do so much practically. What kind of shoot and level of difficulty was this for you compared to?
It was certainly the most difficult thing I had done up till that point. I never had a schedule that was that long and that tiring. I think we were shooting for 5 months, and I know by the end I was a mess. I was really dragging. And because we were outdoors and we were shooting 6 day weeks, which is quite tough. 5 day weeks is the norm, and we were shooting on Sundays in downtown Los Angeles for 10 weeks in a row, because we had to do all of that chase in downtown LA when there are no people down there on Sundays. Certainly not at that time a residential area, except for the homeless community that were around there. So that's where we could fly helicopters down the street and block off 12 blocks at a time,
right?
You know, to get stuff done. That nowadays nobody's going to let you do that. You know, fly stuff,
true.
And as you say, you can do it. You can do it CGI.
Absolutely. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your experience working with both Roy Scheider and Warren Oates, two just fantastic actors. What was that like for you?
Well, Scheider, both these guys are consummate professionals,
mm-hmm.
and yet Warren Oates is just a wonderful, big-hearted cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
With the mind of a cowboy, and you know the stories that you could hear about the Wild Bunch and every night them having these huge tequila blowouts, hiring mariachi bands to play at the sunset as they drank their way into the night, and yet, you know, an amazing actor. You put the two of those guys together, and then Scheider, much more cool, professional, raised in the theater, very, very together with everything that he did. I mean, you never worried when you had those guys on the set because they were always going to bring bring something wonderful to the party.
Right.
Right. Right.
Well, and also, I'll wrap it up. I guess one thing, but also, you got some extra energy by having a very young and very hungry Daniel Stern, who really gives the film that extra bit of energy for these guys to bounce off of.
I know. I just loved him in Breaking Away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And thought that he was just so, you know, wonderful. It was a delightful, goofy quality to him that I thought offset some of the seriousness
mm-hmm.
of it. And once we had made a decision in the script to that somebody had to die in order to persuade people that this group of bad guys was really serious. And you'd want to kill somebody that you liked. So,
right.
You know, he was the sacrificial lamb in a way.
Yeah. But what fantastic films. And Mr. Batham, I'm so sorry we don't have more time, but I know you got to get back to work. and I thank you so much for calling in.
Please come
back to us sometime in the future. We'd love to have you back on. You are one of our favorites, sir.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, and you guys do a great job. I love, you know, I love what you do. It's terrific.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Batham. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That is John Batham. He's on the set of the television series Psych. A great, great guy, great
yes.
director. Enormous talent, and I thank our next guest so much for waiting online. We're running a little bit behind tonight, so thank you so much. Let's get to this now. This is very exciting. Actresses don't come more beautiful and talented than our next guest. For any movie fan out there, certainly from our age group, she has been an indelible presence in all of our lives. Who can forget her radiant performance in E.T., which, of course, it goes without saying, is one of the greatest films ever made. Prior to E.T., she'd already made her mark in several high-profile horror thrillers like The Stepford Wives, The Hills Have Eyes, and the deliriously effective The Howling. And in the summer of 1983, she delivered one of the most amazingly powerful and ferocious performances in her resume as a mother fighting to keep her son safe from the jaws of a rabid St. Bernard in Cujo. Since Cujo, she's worked steadily in the genre in films like Critters, The Frighteners, and Rob Zombie's Halloween. And on the small screen, she's blessed us with a wealth of fine performances in shows as varied as My Name is Earl, The Ghost Whisperer, and Sons and Daughters. She's also a highly skilled acting coach who currently offers her services online, and she has a brand new book on the power of self-healing titled Conscious Creation. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to Movie Geeks United this tremendous actress, Miss Dee Wallace. Let me bring her line up. Miss Wallace, are you there?
I'm here. So listen, you know I'm on the set shooting, and I'm hoping that my cell phone holds out here. If not, I'll have to call you back from another number, okay?
Okay.
I'm so appreciative of your call. Thank you so much. This means a great deal to us to have you on the show.
Oh, too bad. It's my pleasure, and they were great here. They've sprung me for 20 minutes, guys, but I don't know if my cell will hold out that long, so...
Okay, we'll go right to it. Tell me about that summer, the time when Cujo came to you. Obviously, did it come to you, or how did that happen for you?
Actually, Dan Blatt, I had done The Howling for Dan Blatt. He was the producer on it, and also on Cujo. And so when Cujo came along, Dan Blatt brought it to me, and to
mm-hmm.
Chris, who is my husband at the time, because we had both done The Howling for him.
Right.
It was one of the biggest gifts that was ever brought to me, I'll tell you.
It really is, and you know, I rewatched it this weekend, as I've said, it's been many years since I've seen it, but it still works just as well as the first time I saw it. It's terrifying and moving, and I had forgotten somehow about the opening half hour, which is a lot of the family story, and I was so completely taken by that. And I'm wondering, what do you feel that this backstory, that opening of this film, does for the picture? Why it's so essential?
Well, I think, as opposed to most what they're calling horror films these days, it gives you an opportunity to care about and invest in the characters that are going to be at stake here.
Right.
And, you know, the whole... B story of what's going on with the marriage kind of is a metaphor of the energetic and subtle violence that's going on, you know, with the dog and that whole A story part. So I think for me, Cujo works on a lot of different levels, and I, of course, saw. Even back then was dealing with energy and studying energy, and it was a big commentary for me about fear and how people played out fear and
mm-hmm.
and how they used their guilt to really create the fear in their
right.
lives. And I was incredibly lucky to have Danny Pintaro play that little boy too.
Yeah, tell me about that relationship, and tell me about having protecting a child from that kind of. I mean, it's a very obviously it's make believe, but it had to have been a very intense experience.
Well, yeah, it was, and you know, Danny was only 4 at the time, and 4-year-olds like Drew in ET literally oftentimes cannot tell the difference between reality and fantasy. And so with both of them, I would go, all right, now, you know, this is just pretend. You know, the dog isn't really going to hurt us. You know, Carl, you know, has trained the dogs really well. And this is just pretend. This is make-believe. And then after every shot or scene like that, I would go, so Danny, was that fun to play pretend? Because we know that wasn't real. Yeah, I don't know. That's probably why I play so many damn mothers, you know, because I so empathize and worry about the kids and the trauma of what they're going through, you know.
Yeah. I'm fascinated.
He was amazing. He was just amazing to work with and just totally together. He had it. He knew exactly what he was doing.
I'm fascinated by, and obviously you teach acting, and I'm fascinated, especially in this genre of film, how you maintain that kind of state. It's such an emotionally wrought state of being that you're called upon to be in. How do you do that?
You know, it's just a really focused refinement of energy. And you know, you do. You have to be in shape. You have to keep yourself in shape. And you do have to kind of live really in that semi-state during the day while you're shooting it. I mean, Cujo by far is the hardest thing I've ever done. And
yeah.
I was treated for exhaustion for weeks afterwards because I don't think the viewer understands that when an actor goes through an emotional state like that, your body goes through all of the chemical changes that it does if you are really in fight or flight. And
right.
so, you know, your adrenaline pumps out and everything goes into overdrive. And if you look at Cujo, every scene in Cujo, we probably shot 8 to 10, 15 times because the dog and the 4-year-old had to both work in the same scene, and Dee had to work whether they worked or not, you know. So
yeah.
It was taxing. It was physically and emotionally taxing, and I wouldn't have changed that experience for anything.
I'm honest when I say this. I find it a terrific performance, just a time vault performance. I love you in this film.
Yeah.
I want you to tell me about the way it was shot. Was it shot in continuity at all?
Yes, pretty much, because not only for Danny but for the dogs. And
right.
As strange as that may seem, there were 5 dogs, all of them incredibly, impeccably trained to go after different toys. And for all of you animal lovers out there, believe me, the dogs were better taken care of than I was. And we were freezing most of the time. It was November, December in Northern California, and it was raining and really cold. They had to build a heater in the front of that Pinto for us because it was so cold in there.
Oh, wow.
Which is also a testament to Jan de Bont's cinematography and Louis Teague's direction and the performances, because people often say to me, oh, my God, did you just die of the heat? And I'm going, no, we were freezing doing the whole thing. So.
Yeah, and in terms of the movie's ending, I know that the book ended differently. Was there... was there ever any question how you were going to end the movie?
Yeah, in the beginning there was a question, and I said, look, guys, you know, at least half the people that will come to see this movie have never read the book.
Right.
And I just felt incredibly strongly that the child could not, I mean, I really fought for it, and Dan ultimately agreed with me. And then when the film came out, you know, the response was, thank God you didn't kill the kid at the end, because that, I guess, is the most hate mail he ever got.
Yeah, so, I would imagine. And plus it makes sense, too, just because it's a cathartic experience, and you're left with a sense of hope that this family will only be stronger after this point.
Oh, yeah. You can't ask a movie audience to go through 2 hours of that emotional trauma with no payoff. I didn't think, and I was pretty adamant that if I was going to be involved, it needed to have a different ending.
But do you know what? Sorry, this is Aaron. I'm a home entertainment editor. Does anyone know what Mr. King's response was to the film?
Well, that came from Mr. King. Yeah, thank God you didn't kill the kid,
I never got more hate mail
in my life than when I did that at the end of that book.
Because I understand from folklore, he doesn't even remember writing that book. That's like the one book that he's kind of blocked out of his memory.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I think
the key phrase there is part of folklore.
Yeah.
But.
Right.
I know he remembered it enough to take a first pass at the script. So
I know you're pressed for time because you're on set. I want to ask you about two more things before you leave. And one of the things is we've been speaking off and on with a director of yours. His name is Hal Masonberg. Yeah, you were in a film of his called The Plague, and we've been discussing back and forth about what the studio has done with his film and basically taking it away from him. Tell me, in your view, what is missing from the cut that's out there now that is missing from the director's
cut? Well, I'm doing this because I'm not to be involved so much in the political battle here, but in the creative commentary. I loved this original script of Hal's because it made an enormous amount of commentary for me about the human tragedy and the human existence and how our fear literally is the disease that was the plague. And how our if we can conquer our fear and come together in communionship and love, then we can literally heal the world from this disease. And it was a secondary part, but a very, very core part of the script. And it's all been taken out. It just lifted the picture into a whole other genre for me, as opposed to a horror film.
Yeah,
having
seen the director's cut, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I had a real strong reaction to the director's cut as well. I wanted to ask you also, you have a website, it's called officialdwallace.com, and on it your fans can review your movie career and see what's upcoming for you, but you also have a section there about another passion of yours, which is healing. And I want to know what that entails and as an actress, how that kind of concept makes you stronger as an actress and a human being.
Oh, well, you know, the two things are so incredibly tied because they're all about energy, and everything in the world is energy. My whole acting technique is based on energy and channeling really the purity of a character through my instrument. And quite frankly, I think that's what we're all striving to do in our lives right now, is to drop the BS and drop our stories that aren't serving us anymore, and open up our energy to lifting ourselves to the greatest human beings we can be. And many of us do that through our creative, you know, outlets, but life in general should be creative, don't you think?
Absolutely.
And
so,
yeah.
My book, Conscious Creation, and all of my healing work and seminars that I teach is really about finding those blockages and those beliefs and those small places that are woven together in the spider web of our energy that are not allowing us to be the happiest, most joyful people we can be. Because really that's the only reason we're here. We're not here to do great things, and we're not, you know, here to change the world. We're here to be expressions of joy and happiness. And we've just all been really terribly misled about, you know, what that entails in this life. And people oftentimes say to me, how can you justify doing a horror film and healing people? And I go, well, I'm in my joy when I'm an actor. I'm in my joy when I do these films. People come see these films, and they get to face fears that in their real life they would never allow themselves to face in a safe place. And if you read any of the psychological breakdowns of Disney and the Disney films for children, the things that they're always gravitate to are the scary parts, the bad queen in Sleeping Beauty and, you know, Ursula and the Little Mermaid, because it allows them to venture into that place where they can explore their fears and conquer them and know that they're not a part of who they are, that they're an outside fear that they have control over. And I really don't see a dichotomy or a split. I see a perfect parallel to all of it, that it's time for us to all let our fear go. I say in my book that I think the biggest fear we have is losing our fear, because when we have no fear, then we don't have to keep control over everything, and we get to lose our stories. And who are we without our stories? Well, we're just pure energy, and pure energy can decide to be happy and joyful.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. And I was so moved to read some of these sections of your website about healing. And I would highly recommend all of our listeners out there, officialdwallace.com is your website. And you have a book. Has the book been released yet?
It will be released in August, and you can find all about it, you know, exactly the dates. As soon as I get them, I know it's going to be ready in August. And my online acting classes are up on my website. I'm really excited about those. Again, dealing with everything I've ever brought to the screen, you know, around acting and energy. And, I just got my official D. Wallace up, because there's a lot of others out there that aren't mine, really.
Right.
Okay.
And, I look back on Cujo and the Frighteners and all these things, and it really was, all of these things in my career have trained me so well to deal with energy and fear. And ultimately, that's everything my healing work is about. I'm doing this great little movie right now called Fuzz Track City that's going to be made into webisodes and put on the web. So I get to play this great cougar who's having a lot of fun with younger guys. So Yeah, I'm venturing into a whole other area at a time in my life where I'm very happy to do so.
That is fantastic. I know you're on set, so I'll let you get back to it. I appreciate the time you've given us, and please, you're one of our you're very special to us. Please come back to us anytime you'd like in the future.
Yes, please.
Thank you. It was a great interview, guys. I wish you well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wallace. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That is Dee Wallace. She's on the set. We want to have her get back to her work there. Man, we're getting calls from everybody, every working schmo on the set tonight, man.
Yeah, I mean,
give these people some time off.
I know, but everyone's working. That's a good sign, too.
It's very good. And like I said, Cujo, remarkable movie. And, you know, I know that you've seen it recently, Jerry, and probably you've seen it not so long ago, Aaron.
No, there's a really nice, you know, we're talking about DVD, there's a really nice anniversary edition that just came out at the end of last year with a good, almost an hour-long looking back documentary that's really, really good. And I guess we should say that War Games will be getting its 25th anniversary DVD towards the end of July, and there's already a special edition of Blue Thunder.
Oh, great.
It's also really terrific, really beautiful, high-def, widescreen transfer. And as Mr. Badham said, the sound mix, he said it took a long time, and deservedly so, because not only do you have, obviously, the helicopter effects that you gotta mix properly, but it has one of those early 80s, and it's still a very good kind of techno scores, really suspenseful scores, kind of.
It is, and it's not. It doesn't sound gimmicky.
The Tangerine Dream score from Thief. It has some real
Thief, right?
Right.
It has some real tension in it. I didn't get to ask him this. Obviously, what's interesting when he was talking about the mixing, and that last 30 minutes of the film, which is one long action sequence, I gotta assume that all of that was looped. I'm sure, you know, they obviously spoke while filming, but because of all that sound and fury, I'm assuming that was all had to be a lot of ADR was done on that film.
Mm-hmm.
I have to
yeah.
assume. And quite well.
Yeah.
I was kind of reminded of the story when they were making Top Gun, and they were making that final, piecing together the big climax of Top Gun. And they had all this aerial footage, you know, that they had to kind of create a scenario. And it was revealed in one of the documentaries that basically they rewrote the ending in post-production because it was all the dialogue was going to be looped anyways, which is kind of remarkable that they were able to create some kind of ending, you know, a dialogue, if you will, in the last 20 minutes of Top Gun in post-production.
Yeah. Like you said, the War Games 25th annual 25th anniversary edition comes out July 29th.
Mm-hmm.
Cujo 25th anniversary is currently available, and the Blue Thunder special edition was just released a year or two ago. It's on shelves now. All of them are fantastic editions, and especially the War Games promises to be a great one.
Oh, yeah.
We got a lot of fun ahead on the show because we're going to welcome Tom Holland in a few moments. And hopefully he'll be in a relaxed state and not in the middle of a shot or something. And then we're going to play a great montage of some highlights from some movies from the summer of '83. And I tell you, it's going to take you back. Some movies that we haven't even mentioned yet. And, you know, the old commercials and the old trailers 25
right.
years ago, you watch them now, they're so kind of antiquated and just hysterical. So we're going to have some good stuff for you in a little bit, and then we're going to be welcoming Glenn Kenny, one of our greatest film critics, and we're going to talk about a lot of the films that we haven't mentioned thus far that center around that summer, and then we'll be welcoming Keith Ulick to speak about the essays that they're doing on his site dedicated to the summer of '83.
Yeah.
He'll close it out, and it's a great kind of nostalgic time, and Dee Wallace, I'm telling you, I mean, just look at that picture. I mean, she's
mm-hmm.
just gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking forward to her as a cougar. I can't wait to see that.
And you can't help but have those feelings because she played the ultimate mom when we were kids, you know,
yeah,
E.T.
She was. No doubt. She was the ultimate mother.
She played the hot mom of our best friend is what she played, you know, in E.T. and in Holland and so forth. So,
right,
you know,
right.
Dee Wallace here's something while we're waiting for Tom Holland. Just I'll throw it to you guys. What do you think was the best and worst? Because this is a question I'm going to ask Lynn Kenny. What do you think was the best and worst film of the summer of '83?
That's a good name.
Jerry?
I would go with not for the best. You know, it's a toss-up between Return of the Jedi and War Games. The worst? Oh, God. You know, some of these you got to remember. I didn't watch it till videotape the following year.
What was the worst one you actually sat through that summer?
You know what, dude? I have to say, I honestly liked everything I saw that summer. Octopussy,
yeah.
Kroll, Trading Places, and then I later on, and you know, Strange Brew. I still adore to this day.
Let me ask you, did you go see Superman 3 or Jaws?
No, Superman 3, I waited till, like I was telling Jamie earlier, you would not think I wouldn't want to go see a Superman movie, but I heard, read nothing but bad things about it, and you know, it's not like you, when you're younger, you don't have access to a car, so you just can't get in a car and go see it, you know, you gotta wait for your mom or friends, and no one wanted to see it, you know, no one was dying to see Superman 3, so actually, I had forgotten about that, but I'd have to say, as a disappointment, Superman 3 is right up there.
Right.
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit, I'm sure, Glenn Kenny, but it seemed like such a misconception at the start. I mean, talk about mixing of elements that just don't go together necessarily.
Or not fully thinking it out. I mean, okay, you have Richard Pryor, but instead of making Richard Pryor kind of a scaredy cat, make him hip and as smart as Superman. Make him smart like Superman, and kind of you know, make Superman make him hip to what's going on in the world.
Make him
play Superman.
Make him the hipster opposite of Clark Kent. I mean, make him like the. Don't make him another Clark Kent.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
I would. Let me ask you. Like I said, we'll talk about it with Glenn Kenny extensively. Did any of you guys go to the 3D films, or did y'all know that the 3D was bad? And you know, they were just that Hollywood was just trying to.
No, but I saw something better than that. Our local TV station had like the Revenge of the Creature in 3D, and like we all went to 7-Eleven and bought glasses.
I did the same thing.
And
the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
It didn't work. They screwed it up, and my friend's sister started crying because it didn't work. I mean, she's really upset.
Remember they did that on the Super Bowl one time?
Right.
The halftime, it was horrendous. I'm going to say the worst film, and the thing is, though, I've watched it a couple of times just because it's so bad. It's campy, kind of campy fun, but it's such a disappointment that because it's a sequel to such a monumental film, I'm going to have to say Staying Alive. The fact that it was a PG, watered down.
You know, and that's something that we didn't ask Mr. Badham. I mean, that's another summer release related
to
him.
Yeah. I was tempted.
It didn't even dawn on me. Because when I think Mr. Badham, I think quality movies. So.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty sure he shook his head because, as he said, he goes, you know, War Games came out and then you had all these clones of smart kids with computers. I'm sure you can. Insinuate that you know they tried to make Saturday Night Fever mass appeal. What's so bad about Saturday Night Fever? It's not just the dancing or the music. You know that can be just chopped up to taste, but it's just that it's so neutered. I mean, Saturday Night Fever is a hard R. It's like Mean Streets crossed with a studio musical, and Staying Alive has none of the bite of Saturday Night Fever. You just didn't like seeing that character, you know, be nice and be friendly and be.
I will say on that film and the Rocky films, the one crew position that I don't envy is whoever's responsible for applying the shiner on their bodies.
Yeah, the body oil. Good one, Jamie.
I'm telling you, man.
Expensive.
That has to be, forget any other position, that has to be the bottom rung of the entertainment industry. You really want it bad, man.
Yeah.
That's funny. But there are some great movies. There's, you know, I think that above anything, because you asked about the thing that is best about that summer are the comedies.
You're right.
The Man with Two Brains, I keep going back to it. It's so silly, but I laugh hysterically in that movie.
And I think we owe it to our listeners, especially the younger ones, because they might not know that Steve Martin, when he worked with Carl Reiner, made some awesome films.
Man with
and
Two Brains.
And I think people forget that. He's in a lot of these recent stuff, a lot of family-friendly films.
about. All of Me, you know there's
All
some
of me,
there's
the
some
jerk. All those,
there's some physically brilliant comedians out there, and now we look at Steve Martin and he's equally as great, I think. But we look at him as a cerebral comedian.
Mm-hmm.
But back then he was just as smart, just as clever, but his physicality, especially in a movie like All of Me, was just inspired.
Yeah, but when he and Ryan are worked together, it was real magic. The Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid and just great stuff.
And Man with Two Brains is one of the best looking comedies around that time. I believe the cinematographer was Michael Chapman.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a really sharp look. I love that Dr. Necessiter's apartment is one of the great sets of the decade, of the 80s. It's just a great set. And the thing about Man with Two Brains, it's an R-rated film because it was some nudity and some wrongs, but it wasn't tasteless in that it was a film that a lot of kids saw.
It was still very innocent,
Yeah, and kids really got into it. There was a lot of it's funny. It's almost like it was an R-rated family comedy, if there was such a thing.
And Kathleen Turner's
Griffin cameo.
Kathleen Turner's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And the ultimate comedy concert film, Bill Cosby himself.
Bill Cosby.
Cannot tell you how many times I wore out video copies of that concert, playing it over and over again. Classic stuff. Nothing in that movie does not play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything plays. No matter how many times you've seen it.
Big comedy hit of that summer, we're really seeing a star truly just be born, is Trading Places with Eddie Murphy.
I love that film.
It's just one of the it's an old fashioned 40s kind of executive suite comedies, but with Murphy's hipness and smart just delivery that really just takes it into the next level. I mean, he's coming off literally 6 months after 48 hours, and so everyone was just primed for Trading Places, and it was just
even the lesser efforts were still influential, because you hear a director like Tarantino, and people think he says this in jest, but actually I don't think he does. Stroker Ace, the Burt Reynolds movie that opened in July of that summer. It was like incredibly influential for him. He keeps bringing it up.
Oh yeah,
like he loves Stroker
all the time. He's not joking.
I know he's not joking.
He's dead serious.
And we'll bring it up with Tom Holland and that Tarantino's favorite Psycho film is Psycho 2, because he thinks it's more, what did he say? I think he said it has more elegance, and also he loves the fact that Vera Miles, who reprises her role as Marion Crane's sister, Lila Loomis,
mm-hmm.
is one of the great villains of the 80s. He just finds it so hateful.
We're waiting for Mr. Holland to call in. But along these same lines that I'm going on with the comedies, I mean, that's absolutely where I think this summer perseveres. We have one of Woody Allen's most innovative comedies, which is Zelig.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
We have National Lampoon's Vacation.
Yeah,
something that's lived.
That's hilarious. I mean, that's great.
And one of my favorite movies growing up, Mr. Mom. I mean, can you beat Mr. Mom?
Mr. Mom was classic.
The thing about Mr. Mom, to give you some context, that National Lampoon's Vacation came out, and everyone was going to go see that because Chevy Chase. So it was National Lampoon, and Chevy Chase was so big, so everyone was going to that. And then Mr. Mom comes out on the radar. In its first week, it does modest, not real big, but it goes on to do like $65 million. It really became a word of mouth. And what happened was Vacation would be sold out, and everyone would go to Mr. Mom.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
Night Shift was a year earlier, which was a modest film, but was really getting an audience on HBO.
Well, it was a very funny film.
Michael Keaton was really coming to his own. And we want to talk a little political here. Mr. Mom is interesting in that it comes out in 83.
Yeah.
So we're not at the full swing of Reaganomics, but we're really getting into it. But Mr. Mom really is sort of prophetic in that transition of men being downsized and women going to work and men becoming domestics, homemakers. And also we're seeing with Mr. Mom, we're seeing the death really of families that could survive on a one income household, in that the father worked and the mother was at home. But here Mr. Mom really is prophetic in that it shows that you know, both parents are going to have to work. And so Mr. Mom
right.
has a little political content that obviously
and
people
didn't all comedies work. All comedies work when they have that kernel of truth in it.
Right.
But the comedic premise right there, this awkward guy has to be the homemaker.
Yeah,
and
I love
Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton with all his manic energy.
Yeah, and he was great. Driving the kids
was,
to school, and it, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. And the crossing guard's like, you're doing it wrong.
I still quote when I go to the store and I go to the deli. It's like, can you just go through the hams one more time, just to
right.
connect with the deli? I mean, no, Mr. Mom has some really terrific stuff. And so yeah, I mean, comedy. All summers really have their comedy nick. And Vacation was just, you know, that really everyone could relate to Vacation,
mm-hmm.
no
yeah.
matter what. And then the surprise, every summer had that big sleeper hit, and that would have to be Risky Business, where
right.
obviously it was advertised as another teenage sex comedy, but really, like Mr. Mom and other films, was really about the emphasis on money that was prevalent throughout the 80s. Basically, you know, the character Tom Cruise plays, he's the yuppie. He's the first teenage yuppie, if you will.
He wants to take a walk on the dark side.
Yeah.
And you know, it's he had done, you know, all the right moves. He just taps. He had established himself before, but this really established
that.
Him as a star. I mean, Risky Business was his entry into, you know, the star making business, really.
And Rebecca De Mornay, and another Joe Pantoliano, who we've had on
yeah.
the
show. Joey Pants.
Curtis Armstrong, and another terrific early '80s score. By Tangerine Dream. Got to remember, back in the 80s, it was a East Coast, West Coast rivalry between Tangerine Dream and Vangelis. And,
yeah.
They had to throw down.
Yeah, I know. That's the most mellow war I've ever heard of in my
yeah.
life.
yeah.
There's two movies that I want to talk to between us. And Mr. Holland has not called in yet. I sent him a reminder last night. Hopefully he'll call in. But even so, we have plenty to talk about.
I wanted to talk about
okay. two movies that I'd like to talk about. One of which, not a lot to say except for this. They say that this movie, out of all of the hidden treasures in the 80s, need to be remade. And that is Michael Douglas's The Star Chamber, which came out in August of that year.
God, I haven't seen that in so long.
That is so true. Of course, IMDb, and who knows how reliable IMDb is, there is a page for a remake of Star Chamber for 2009 that it has no credits, no screenwriter, no director, no actor attached, but apparently it's somewhere out there. And I just recently saw this a few weeks ago, and I think the reason it gets a lot of play on TV is frankly because it's that pre-Romance in the Stone Michael Douglas film. So, you know, people look at the early Michael Douglas, but ever a film really did need a remake and could be so exciting is The Star Chamber. It has such a great premise. Then it's so kind of haphazardly executed.
It is, and
the premise
is essentially the group of judges acting as vigilantes. Is that
right.
vigilantes? Is that the premise essentially?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
They're basically like a Supreme Court. There's nine judges, and they meet in this basement. And whenever there's a case, be it a rape or a murder or some severe crime, has been tossed out of a certain judge's court on a technicality, whether the police didn't do this or the warrant didn't do that, they present the case, and if it's a unanimous vote of guilty, they hire someone to execute. And it's these judges who are just tired of having to adhere to technicalities and getting guilty people off. And that is a great premise. I mean, we talked about Dirty Harry a couple weeks ago. I mean, it's now Dirty Harry has like now become a judge, and it's just it's terrific. But you know, they turn it into an action film with a chase when it can be so much more thought provoking, particularly nowadays in this post 9/11 vigilante kind of atmosphere. The Brave One tried to do that, but it did so poorly because it was so retrograde that, you know, The Star Chamber really is ripe for a remake. And frankly, Michael Douglas could be in it again. He could now be he plays the young judge, and Hal Holbrook plays the veteran judge who
right.
brings him into this The Star Chamber. Now, you know, Michael Douglas at a point, he could play the Hal Holbrook character, and it'd be very good. He hasn't played a villain in a long time, and I think he'd be terrific to switch roles. And
yeah.
It'd be a good thriller. I do hope they remake it, and I hope they remake it smartly.
Right. It is a great premise.
What's the other film, Jamie?
The other film that I wanted to bring up, and I got a lot to say about it, and my feeling is that we're 15 minutes into the segment, so Mr. Holland's probably not calling in. And Aaron, did you give me Mr. Kinney's area code when you sent over the information?
I don't think so. I will send it now.
What's the first letter? What's the first number?
Six.
Okay.
Six.
I'll be on the lookout for that. Okay. I want to talk about Twilight Zone.
Thank you.
Yeah, because this was a real defining moment of this summer of 83. For those of you that are not aware, The Twilight Zone was a TV show. No, I'm kidding. They finally, Spielberg was looking for a next big project. He went into his agent's office and said, they were flipping through scripts, and the agent said, Twilight Zone. And he said, that sounds interesting. He was waiting for an opportunity to collaborate with a close friend of his, John Landis. They'd been meaning to work together since Jaws. Landis came into Jaws and had some ideas for rewrites that they didn't use, but they struck up a chord because Landis was kind of the sorority house brother that Spielberg never was. He was the outgoing version of Spielberg.
Right,
And so they had some kind of camaraderie going. So this was an opportunity for them to do an anthology film based on the Twilight Zone series, and they decided to bring in two other directors, which were Joe Dante and George Miller.
I mean... Everyone at the top, everyone was like really hot. I mean, these are all...
Top of the game.
Yeah, top of the game.
Yeah. And it seemed like, for Warner Brothers, a can't-miss project. Four half-hour Twilight Zone films from four top directors. A great idea for an anthology series.
Mm-hmm.
Landis shot his first. Landis actually wrote his original, an original script, based on what... the sense that he got from the Twilight Zones, that they were political in a way that wasn't obvious, but there was always an undercurrent of, Rod Serling always brought in an undercurrent of politics in there, liberal politics mostly, and his script testified to that. It was a racist, bigoted man, who found himself in extreme situations, Nazi Germany, Vietnam, where he was the person that was being looked upon as the outsider, as the one that he would always ridicule. Dynamite premise, actually, I think. He cast Vic Morrow, who, for those of you that aren't aware, I mean, Vic Morrow probably most famous for Combat, the television series.
And Blackboard Jungle.
He's the father of Jennifer Jason Leigh.
And don't forget the Bad News Bears.
Yeah. Father of Jennifer Jason Leigh is one of our top actresses. The scene called for the Vietnam sequence. It called for Vic Morrow to save two Vietnamese children from a battle.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes into this little hut and he sees two little Vietnamese children who ended up being on the set that night working illegally. He carries them under his arm across like a little pond area, bombs, helicopters flying above, and he saves them, essentially. So they're shooting this scene, and Vic Morrow doesn't feel right about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a lot about this episode. Vic Morrow actually had a premonition that he'd get killed in a helicopter accident a few months earlier, I imagine. And it was one of the great tragedies.
Mm-hmm.
There was something mishapped on the set and took Vic Morrow's life and the life of those two children. But in terms of repercussions from a movie that came out that summer, I think it really made people strap down and look at safety, and it was a big long court trial too.
It was
safety
that went on
precautions,
for a long time.
Children on sets, and that kind of thing. I mean, I think that movie above anything else that summer brought about some change, some worthy change in the industry.
It's funny you bring that up because listening to the Blue Thunder commentary, Badham talks. He touches on that because you got to remember they filmed a little after. Around the same time as Twilight Zone, and so they're also dealing with helicopters, and so they really had to be careful. And they're in L.A., live L.A. urban city, and so they were also very conscientious of safety. There's some shots in Blue Thunder where the helicopter is only 10 feet above you know, the city streets. But they, you know, the rules were changing in the midst of filming Blue Thunder on safety and precaution. What's interesting about Twilight Zone,
our next guest is on the line, so if
Well, the interesting thing about Twilight Zone is that really, the veterans, Landis and Spielberg's segments are really the duds, but it's the up and comers, Dante and Miller, who are coming off cult films, you know, Howling and Road Warrior.
Right.
Those are the guys who really shine in that film.
I think so too, particularly Miller with that Lithgow piece of the airplane. That
was
a classic.
That is.
That's some kind of delirious classic, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, our next guest is on the hold, and we're so excited about this. The Movie Geeks are honored to welcome to the show a multi-talented writer-director who has been the brainchild behind some of horror's most iconic films from the past 25 years. And it all started with a script for the highly anticipated Psycho 2 during the summer of 1983, which saw the return of Norman Bates to the big screen after an absence of 23 years. He's also the man behind Child's Play, which introduced the world to the infamous murdering doll Chucky, and the irresistible vampire film Fright Night, which continues to thrive among new generations of moviegoers. Other films that grace his resume include Fatal Beauty, The Beast Within, The Temp, Thinner, and Cloak and Dagger. And his work in television is equally impressive and includes writing and directing duties on Stephen King's The Langoliers and contributions to both the Tales from the Crypt and Masters of Horror anthology series. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Tom Holland. Mr. Holland, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you for the wonderful introduction.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us. I can't thank you enough.
Well, I apologize for being a little bit late.
Are you working? Are you in the middle of a shoot or anything?
Yeah, well, yes, there are a lot of things going on. Yeah, there are.
We've had that with our previous two guests. They've been calling from location, so it's going around tonight. Tell me a little bit about, you've said that Psycho 2 you consider your big break into the industry. Tell me where you were before that came about and how the opportunity did come about for you for Psycho 2.
Let's see if I can give a build-up. I've been writing originals through the 70s. I started to get television work in the 70s. I got a movie of the week called The Initiation of Sarah, which I wrote, which at the time was quite notorious. It was recently remade, actually, the only television show I've ever had that's been remade. And It was on ABC, and I think it was the first overtly sort of what they called the jiggle, a TV show. There was a scene in it that was about sorority girls who were witches, and there was a scene in it where the fight carried the girls into the fountain, and they came out with wet T-shirts, and that was that had to be around 78 or 79. Then I got The Beast Within, which was the first feature that I did. And I thought that was a terrific script, but the movie wasn't a success, and I didn't work for a year after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I think I got Class of 84 before Psycho 2.
Right.
But then I got Psycho 2, and that was the first. Certainly wasn't the first job. I'd been a working writer then for a number of years, but it was the first job that turned into an enormous international success.
Well, I would imagine, and just to think of the masterpiece that was Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960.
Yeah.
23 years have passed. This must have been an incredibly daunting project for you.
Daunting, intimidating, terrifying, going into something, you know, expecting the critics to just roast you alive for even attempting it, all of that. Yes, it was terrifying, intimidating.
Yeah, I would imagine. Did they have ideas that they wanted you to flesh out, or did they just give you carte blanche on where to take the story? How did that work?
No, let's see if I can remember. And this is said with a great amount of respect. Robert Bloch had done a sequel, had written a book that was a sequel, and it didn't work in the sense that it was not a story that used the Norman Bates character the way any of us would have liked to have seen him be used dramatically. It wasn't a commercially satisfying novel, and I say that having an overwhelming respect for Mr. Block,
mm-hmm.
who was the mentor to an awful lot of people, including Stephen King.
That's right.
But his sequel novel did not work, and so it was a tabula rasa in that sense. And the question was how to do a movie that would be faithful to the first one, and yet would use one of the qualities that made Norman so such a stunning characterization by Anthony Perkins, which was that you had a psychopathic serial murderer that you felt sorry for.
Right,
you know, that you identified with, that you understood his mother had driven him insane, and although what he was doing was terrible, you still sympathized with him, and that was
right.
the character that Tony had created in the first one, and it was how to take that to the next level in the sequel. That was my feeling about what it should accomplish dramatically, and it was
go ahead. I'm sorry, sir.
No, please go ahead.
So that was how you kind of established that sympathy for the character by establishing a kind of subplot to work against Norman, work against his efforts to rehabilitate?
What I'm saying was what you saw working in the first movie in Psycho, made among the many things that made it stunning was that Norman Bates was a sympathetic psychopathic murderer. And I'm not even saying that was because of the screenplay. It was, yes, the screenplay, yes, but it was really what Tony did with the character.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
So, therefore, that was the character that you wanted to see in the sequel. And realizing that dramatically, that was how I pitched the story to the director, Richard Franklin, and got the job. So now how to accomplish that was something else. The underlying premise of Psycho 2 was that you have a psychopath who's been rehabilitated and has been let back into society, and what's sympathetic about it is he's desperately trying to hold on to his sanity, and
right.
the relatives of his previous victims are not happy or feel that justice has been betrayed, and they decide to drive him mad, so they can put him back in the insane asylum. And, of course, it backfires. But the sympathy for Norman is that even as Norman's grasp on sanity begins to loosen, he's desperately trying to hold on to it.
You still so desperately want to cheer for him, to pull through.
It was always I don't know whether the right word is irony or the duality,
mm-hmm.
but it was always part of what made Norman Bates such a fascinating character. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, were you a presence on the set during shooting of that film?
Yeah, I was.
What are some of your fond memories of that particular set?
Well, it was just a terrific experience. It was a happy film. I just recently going through the memorabilia I have, I came across the whole bunch of Polaroids. Does anybody even know what a Polaroid is anymore, I wonder?
Yeah, that's funny. They don't make them anymore.
I know. But I tell you, the quality wasn't good. I hadn't looked at them in 27 years or however long it's been, and there were Polaroids on the set. And with myself and Robert Loggia clowning with the knife sticking out of Robert Loggia. And
he has one of the great death scenes in the whole film.
It's terrific, yeah.
Was that in the script, the hitting the banister and the knife going in further, or was that obviously something, or is that something that, like, let's do it a little more and really kind of stick it to the audience with that?
That was all in the script. That was probably the closest writing experience I've ever had with a director,
mm-hmm.
where not only did I wrote it, but then we looked at the mise-en-scène or the visual set pieces, whatever you want to call them, and I wrote them, mm-hmm. too. we felt that we had to, and this sounds gratuitous, but we felt that we had to give a certain amount of what in those days was gore, I guess. And among those, what you're talking about is he falls, and there's a close-up as he hits the floor and drives a knife further through his body. Right. Also, in that category would be the knife going through Vera Miles' throat and out the back of her head.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
The times changed since 1960, didn't they?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting discussion too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But there was no question that was the direction that you wanted to go to appeal to a more modern audience.
Well, yes, but they were touches. And there were three
right.
or four of them. They were Norman grabbing the knife that Meg Tilly is wielding, trying to hold him back.
Right, right.
And they pull the knife through his bare hands. That was a scream. But those shots, we deliberately added those shots, and I can't remember, five or six different places now. And I wrote them into the script, yes.
Well, Hitchcock did the same thing. I mean, back in 1960, what Hitchcock did, those five or six shock moments he put in his Psycho, I mean, they must have been equally as terrifying and as shocking back then as they were in Psycho 2 and 83.
You can count on it. Richard Franklin, the director of Psycho 2, was a devotee and a student of Hitchcock and had gone to visit him at Universal when Richard was at USC. So, I mean, they're the whole film is a homage to Hitchcock. There is a pan around Mother's bedroom, and if you look carefully, you'll see a silhouette of Alfred Hitchcock on the wall.
I saw that, yes.
Because we wanted Hitchcock to make an appearance in the film, as he did in all of his films.
Absolutely. Tell me about Richard Franklin, because obviously this was a collaboration that worked, and because you guys did it again. Tell me about that collaboration.
Richard Franklin was an Australian.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, he went to USC.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the vanguard of the Australian film movement at the time. He was probably one of the few Australians doing overtly commercial films. He did a film called Rogue Games and another film called Patrick,
mm-hmm.
both of which echo Hitchcock. It's how he got the job, actually, I think.
Rogue Games, for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
He was a very, very nice fellow. He was dry. He had an academic personality. He's now passed away, but he was teaching at the university in Sydney, I think, and I can't remember the name of the university, but he was teaching film. I mean, he worked, throughout his life, but he also taught. He educated me in Hitchcock. I remember him giving me books of criticism. Robin Wood, I think.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Yeah,
book.
Which I think was the critic that he respected most of Hitchcock's films. We dissected together. We ran, I don't know how many of Hitchcock's films, and those were in the days when VHS cassettes had just come out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we would take things. I can't remember all. Certainly, obviously, Psycho, but a lot of all the other Hitchcock films. Some very, ones lesser known. Like,
right.
I believe, not The Lodger, which is famous, but like Blackmail, which was the first sound film done in England. I believe it was shot in 1929 or 30, and Hitchcock directed that. By the way, Ronnie Neim was the first AD on that, if you really want to get into minutia.
Right.
Ronnie Neim directed the first Poseidon Adventure.
Right.
So that was a group around Hitchcock. So Richard and I dissected the action set pieces or mise en scène or whatever you want to call of Alfred Hitchcock as we did the film, and then we built the visual set pieces in once we had the dramatic framework and a scene by scene breakdown.
Right, right. And it
was a very meticulously planned film.
Yeah, yeah. I've been watching these past couple of weeks. I've been going back through old interviews with Mr. Perkins, and he always seemed the common question was, don't you feel typecast with this iconic character? And he always seemed to feel quite the opposite. He seemed to relish in being able to bring this character to audiences. What was your experience working with him and just observing him work?
He was brilliant. I mean, I don't know if I can say that about any other. I don't say that about very many other people, actors or otherwise. But Tony Perkins was brilliant. I mean, his best friend was Stephen Sondheim, I believe. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of the film business and who did what. There was a game back in those days, which they still may play, the movie game. You name a star, and I name a movie that star was in. Now you have to name another actor that was in that movie, and you keep the chain going until you lose.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Tony could play it with cinematographers, composers, the directors. I mean, he knew everybody was creatively important, and it seemed to me like every film ever made, films like Three Jills in a Jeep from 1941,
right.
I mean, stuff that you'd never heard of. Now today that would be impossible, probably with the onset of so many DVD movies. But in those days, back in the early 80s, you still were dealing mainly with classic, what we call classic cinema now.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had that. He also had that about music, about classical music, about opera. I mean, it was an encyclopedic knowledge of high culture. He was high culture. He was not lowbrow. He was highbrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. There's no doubt about it. We're talking about the summer of 1983. Our guest is Tom Holland. Our next guest, Glenn Kinney, terrific critic, is on the line, and we're going to get to that segment in just a moment. We're running a little bit over. But before I let you go, Mr. Holland, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about another film in your resume that has just endured, and it's just a terrific film, and that's Fright Night. We talked to Chris Arandon a couple of weeks ago when we did a Sidney Lumet tribute, and he spoke to his experience on that film. He said that was, outside of Dog Day Afternoon, that was the only film, yours, Fright Night, that allowed him a period of rehearsal.
Yeah, we had 2 weeks rehearsal on that. I've always rehearsed all of my films, but I've never done 2 weeks again. Over the years, it's gone down to like 4 and 5 days. And I will say that the film is going to have a midnight screening on September 19th at the New Arts Cinema on Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica, California.
That's going to be great.
The film is just amazing. It's become generational or intergenerational now. And its reputation seems to keep growing because it is a film that the parents can share with their children. It's just, the longevity of it and the way it's growing just amazes me. And the warmth. I think it's because of the warmth and the humor. And finally, it's a film about a horror fan who finds his fantasies come true, much to his horror, and a vampire moves in next door.
but you have struck lightning. You obviously have the Psycho fan base. You have Child's Play, which was such an influential film, and Fright Night, and some of the other works that you've done. Tell me about being embraced by this community of horror fans. Tell me about that community.
Well, I have to tell you, I've only become aware of it in the last couple of years. Become newly aware of it. In the last couple of years with the Masters of Horror that I did, it has grown so much. You have to remember when I did Fright Night, I think Fangoria was like 2 or 3 years old. So they were interviewing me on Fright Night, but not on Psycho 2. So they were not moving on Psycho 2. So I was there at the birth. I think I went to. I know I went to a Fangoria convention for Child's Play, and it had just started then, and that's probably 86, 87, and it has grown enormously. I think it's cyclical. I think it's just wonderful, and I love the fans, and I love the fact that it's now parents and their children, and it also encompasses women now. I could go on and on about this,
mm-hmm,
but
yes,
you've got somebody else waiting.
Right.
Well,
it's a fascinating phenomenon, fellas, and it's growing, and it's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are crazy about you.
I'll also add one other thing. I pulled all the reviews from the original Psycho from 1960, Hitchcock, and
uh-huh.
it was universally reviled by every
oh,
major
yes.
critic
oh,
in America.
Oh, it was. That's very true.
Just attacked viciously. I mean, so that's a fascinating comment on where because Hitchcock's Psycho was really what started it in 1960,
mm-hmm.
and I think
yeah.
that's a fascinating comment. You know, and then you look at where we are today in 2008.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Well, I would love we can continue this conversation forever.
Forever.
And we love your work, and we would welcome you back on the show in a heartbeat. Will you please come back sometime in the future?
Yeah,
I'll be
like,
more than happy to. Thank you, fellas.
It. Thank you.
Thank you so much,
okay,
Mr. Holland.
God bless. Have a good week. I hope the show is great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
okay,
sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you
now.
So much. Bye-bye, gentlemen.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. That's Tom Holland. Great guy. Great
yeah.
guy. Nice little interview.
He worked with Anthony Perkins and Roddy McDowell. It's awesome.
That's all you need.
Really incredible.
That's all you need. Okay, our guest has been waiting on the phone. We've been running behind since the very beginning of the show, it seems.
Yeah, we have.
We're so sorry. We apologize. Our final guest has been a lover of movies since the age of one, when he watched Psycho enthusiastically at a drive-in. Throughout the 1980s, he made his mark as a rock and movie critic for such publications as The Village Voice and Video Review. In 1996, he became a contributing editor for Premiere Magazine, one of the very best, I'm sure we all agree on this, movie-oriented publications on the newsstands. There, he oversaw the editing of such landmark articles like David Foster Wallace's exhaustive David Lynch profile, David Lynch Keeps His Head, and he would move from contributing to senior editor and later chief film critic and home entertainment editor for that magazine. He has recently parted ways with Premiere.com, but he's quickly making marking his territory in the blogosphere. His blog, Some Came Running, is required daily reading for any serious film lover. Please welcome to Movie Geeks United a tremendous critic we all think a lot of, Mr. Glenn Kinney. Mr. Kinney, are you with us?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I was trying to chime in there and say, hey, Tom Holland, don't go away. you know, I would love to talk to him about Psycho 2, Class of 84, a lot of stuff that he's been involved in. And I heard him mentioning Robin Wood, and that is the real critical voice that rehabilitated Psycho, as he very accurately points out. In the early days, the actual reviews of Psycho were incredibly negative. The only, Andrew Saras was the guy who stood up at the Village Voice, which was then a very new paper at the time, and stood up for it. Robin Wood wrote a extremely exhaustive essay on the film and submitted it to Sight and Sound, and Penelope Houston told him, well, that's all very well and good, but, you know, everybody knows that Psycho was just a joke, and that was the story of Robin Wood's first try at film criticism. I believe he was planting trees in England at the time. So,
Does it seem, though, that critics, do you think that they resented being played that way? I mean, because Hitchcock was a master at playing the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an older guy, and I can't pretend to remember the reviews of Psycho, but I think that there was a certain aspect of critics feeling played, but there was also an aspect, and this was something that was very much happening at the turn of the 50s and into the 60s.
I think, Mr. Kinney,
where you had this thing going on where, in English language criticism, the influence of Cahiers du Cinéma was being felt, and so American critics weren't used to the idea that Hitchcock was this, you know, auteur who needed to be taken seriously, who had a body of work that was going, from, the 30s to the 40s to the 50s. They thought he was just, a maker of entertainments, and that's how he played himself in his publicity materials as well. He says, I don't make slices of life I make slices of cake. So Psycho was a very peculiar slice of cake coming from Hitchcock, you know?
Well, it does. It is interesting. I remember Entertainment Weekly Owen Gleiberman's review of the Gus Van Sant shot for shot remake of Psycho pointed out that that really the howler of the Gus Van Sant remake is that it was present day, because Psycho,
yeah,
the original Psycho is really, it really basically puts the knife in the heart of the 50s, really. And you know, that would come even further in the late 60s, but really Psycho is the first film from 1960. It really just kind of obliterates that kind of 50s fake happy facade and just obliterates it.
Oh yeah, it totally does. And Hitchcock, in fact, expressed his frustration in his book of interviews with Truffaut that he wasn't able to be more frank in the motel scenes between Janet Leigh and John Gavin. But I think we're kind of moving away from our
summer of 83.
We're
going back to the fall of 59 and the spring of 60. Let's try and move back to the summer of 83.
All right. Well, I'll start with my first question. Is that summer of 83? You were, I believe, mostly you were 23 years old, Glenn, and about to turn 24. So
yeah, I was 23, about to turn 24. August 8th is the line of demarcation.
What do you remember? What are your immediate memories of that summer? As just, I don't remember if you were freelancing as a film critic, but I know I'm assuming you were getting.
Oh, Aaron, let me tell you what I was doing. I wasn't doing a goddamn thing.
Okay.
I was pretty much.
Hey, sounds like me at that age. Yeah.
Okay. I was telemarketing, and I was doing the freelance work I was doing as a rock critic.
Okay.
I will, to tell you. And so that involved, hanging around by my stereo and not really doing much of anything.
So obviously you had the ability to kind of actually now you at this point, since you're not doing a film criticism, you could really pick and choose what you were seeing.
My friends and I used to go to the where did we go? We went to the Wayne, the Short Hills Mall, and the Wayne Mall, and we would see as many movies as we could. Quite frankly, we weren't we weren't choosy. I mean, we saw a lot of the films we've been discussing tonight. We didn't see. Let's see. Dr. Detroit. Yeah, Blue Thunder. We saw. We definitely saw Breathless because we were just so fascinated by the idea that somebody would do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, Richard Gere as John Paul Belmondo?
What did you think? Tarantino is on record of actually really loving this remake.
It's a ridiculous film. I remember the controversy going on about the financing of the film and Jim McBride and L.M. Kit Carson being very agitated because Barry Diller at Paramount, who was running Paramount at the time, says, "No, I won't finance this film. It's about a cop killer," which kind of gave you this very interesting idea that 30 years after the fact, that this was still kind of a controversial, that this thing that was really nothing more than a trope, was actually a controversial thing.
Well, because we're getting back into Reagan's in office, so we're getting conservative again.
Yeah. And, Barry Diller's still around, sort of, to a certain extent, determining what we will and will not see. But, no, it wasn't a good film.
No, of course not.
And
I never understood that about Tarantino, though. He says he loves Godard, names a production company after, one of his films. Oh, but I like the remake much better.
We already established that one of his favorites is Stoker Ace. So,
Stoker Ace and the McBride version of Breathless have nothing to do with each other. He likes the McBride version of Breathless because it has excuse me, Valerie Kavirsky running around naked.
About two-thirds
of the film.
You're absolutely right.
That's the only thing it has to recommend it. And, you know, that's no small thing if you're a heterosexual, especially in 1983, if you're in your 20s or in your late teens or something, and you're like, I hope you got the sound effects. But, you know, that is no small thing. So there you have it.
Well, here's it. So what did it mean to that first generation to see the concluding installment of a Jedi? What did that mean? Because it's 6 years earlier, 1977, so...
Because
there's a whole maturation cycle that goes on between those 6 years when you're 16 to now you're 23. So what did that mean, seeing Jedi finally?
Well, we had grown up and none of us ever believed, you know, despite the protestations of the putative machinations of George Lucas, none of us ever believed that the episodes 1 through 3 would ever actually materialize.
Or be that bad.
Well, materialize and be that bad are, you know, we only got into the be that bad speculations once we realized that they were actually being made. I mean, this is the advantage of age, not to lord it over you guys, but when, you know, Return of the Jedi came out, I mean, we were already kind of forewarned by the fact that Return of the Jedi had been changed from Revenge of the Jedi. It's like, oh, wait, no, I'm very zen. No, seriously, you had to be there. I mean,
I was there.
You were there. Okay.
Yes,
so
I remember the big deal when they changed the title. You don't have to. I have a revenge poster somewhere, but yeah.
There was quite a bit of eye rolling.
Yeah.
You know, you're just sort of like, what the? You know, I mean, you know, Empire Strikes Back took a lot of us by surprise because we thought like, oh, this is kind of dark and not, you know, well, he's walking the walk, so. You know, when he starts going on about the Ewoks being kind of akin to the Viet Cong, it's like, no, they're really not.
So we're, were Ewoks reviled on site back in 83, or did that grow over the years?
I think it grew over the years. I think the reaction of the people who saw them as, you know, young adults, as I was, was just more or less a sort of like, that was the reaction. And it was only after the sort of obsessives kind of like got involved in and said, oh yeah, they're Ewoks, George Lucas says they represent the Viet Cong, that people really were able to codify this thing and say, oh my God, this is horrifying and awful, and why we can't have anything to do with it, you know. That was the thing. It was sort of a gradual process of alienation, as you know. I mean, the alienation was there from watching the film in the theater in the first place. But if you didn't just walk out of the theater and say, "I washed my hands of the whole thing," and then bothered to learn more about it, then the alienation got even worse.
It's interesting to note, in my view of the film, is that one thing that never gets noted is that actually Mark Hamill becomes a better actor as the series goes on.
Jedi,
he actually, I think, gives a very heartfelt, sincere performance. Mark Hamill, to me, is actually underrated in the Star Wars films because he has a wide-eyed believability in playing off of, you know, basically puppets that not any actor can just do. And he really
You know, that's not exactly a resume booster. I mean,
I
understand I understand exactly what you're saying, and I actually feel kind of bad for Mark Hamill because, you know, I mean, I think, I mean, if we're going to go into, like, careers that were, you know, made and ruined by the Star Wars trilogy, this is going to get into the realms of.
Well, we won't get too negative.
We're going to be up all night.
We won't get too. I'm just saying, yes, Mark Hamill. I mean, it's not. It doesn't mean you're going to be getting Taxi Driver, but it is a skill that not every. It's a skill that, frankly, Robert De Niro doesn't have.
So I
do think he gets shortchanged on that. But
no, of course Hamill gets shortchanged, but you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of the nature of the beast when you're in a when you're in this kind of film to get shortchanged as an actor. It's just I nobody's career out of Star Wars came out the way they envisioned it. I mean, Harrison Ford didn't probably envision where he's at either. You know,
right.
Carrie Fisher thought that maybe she'd work as a character actress for the rest of her life. I mean, everybody's every actor in Star Wars. Yeah, every actor who's in Star Wars has had their career defined in a way, for better or worse, that they might not have predicted for themselves.
Even Lucas.
Oh yeah.
Let me ask you. Let's talk about a couple of trends in the summer of '83. What was you and your group of friends? What was your immediate reaction? What was your feeling when you saw that Hollywood was going to roll out 3D again, and that they did all through '83 and they stopped at the end of '83? You had obviously
we were extremely skeptical and we weren't having it. And
did you go see anything? Because you had Space Hunter, you had Jaws 3D, you had Friday the 13th, you had 3D.
We at the age of 23 felt way too mature. You know, we were kind of suspended between two worlds. We couldn't get into the city to see La Truite or Return of Martin Guerre necessarily, but we would see things like Trading Places, which I know is a big favorite of my friend Dave Kerr, and Superman 3, which we felt very let down by, you know. That was, you look at something and you say,
"You love Richard Lester," but
You love Richard Lester, but you like sit there and you go, "Okay, we're gonna have an entire film in which the plot points are narrated by Richard Pryor to Robert Vaughn for the next 2 hours."
Yeah.
Something is clearly wrong in the creation of the scenario here, you know?
Right. Well, now, here's some. We talked about Twilight Zone earlier, so let's talk about Twilight Zone. In that here, what did it mean, or did it mean anything that the young directors Dante and George Miller showed veterans like Landis and Spielberg because Twilight Zone, obviously everyone went because of just the curiosity of the controversy.
Yeah.
But the first half of Twilight Zone is, other than you have that prologue, which is terrific. But
yeah.
Then you, because you get the credence, but then you get Landis's truncated short that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You get Spielberg, in my view, his first truly big misfire. I actually like parts of 1941, but I feel like Japan is just awful, and you almost want to leave the theater. But then you get these two young up-and-coming guys, Dante and Miller, and they kind of just give that whole film another energy. What was that like?
Well, it's interesting that you put it in those terms, because For us, we didn't see it that way.
Really?
Spielberg, Landis, Dante, and Miller were, you know, in terms of age, we're all kind of peers. I mean, that's how the film was actually packaged, and that's how the film was presented to us. What the difference was just the difference based on what kind of movies they had made. You know, Spielberg kind of hewed to the more sentimental themes that he had that he had been working in other things. But you know, Landis, I mean. You know, we were just. I mean, it's hard to talk about the film because it was kind of a film that we kind of a lot of us went to under protest, you know, because...
How do you mean?
Well, the whole thing with Landis and the death of Vic Miller and all that stuff was just... was really unpleasant and unsettling to us, and we felt that, you know, to really, you know, there were a bunch of us who felt that, you know, the film should not have been released in the first place. And it's interesting that you should point out the differences in ages. I mean, looking at it now, George Miller, who directed Mad Max and The Road Warrior, is born in 1945. Spielberg is actually a year younger than him, born in 46. Landis is the youngest of the bunch, born in 1950. And Dante is born in 1946. So you've got three peers plus Landis, who was born about 4 or 5 years after those guys. They really all were of the same generation and all were, therefore, as, you know, television watchers and such, kind of equally qualified to, you know, do a treatment of The Twilight Zone. But, you know, what Spielberg served up was kind of a appetizer for Cocoon. It was very maudlin and, you know, I mean, they were all based on previously written and created Twilight Zone film episodes, if you'll excuse me. Mm. But, you know, they all had their distinctive take on them. And I think Dante's sequence, which has a lot of animation, original animation and so on, is probably the most successful and interesting of the bunch.
The Miller one is the one, is the one that's actually straight out terror. That's just,
yeah.
You know, and it's compact.
And that was, you know, Miller was extremely well suited to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was to tell you about movie buffs, you know, who were in their early 20s in 1983. The reason we went to see The Twilight Zone, as much as we deplored it, because we all were pretty offended by, you know, Landis at the time. We wanted to see the Miller and Dante. Those were the two guys whose work we wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We weren't particularly... You know, we kind of felt that the Spielberg thing would be, you know, predictable. But what we wanted to see was what Miller and Dante would do with those respective sequences.
Well, I just have two more questions. We'll start wrapping this up. And this is every summer. You know, now summers are all broken down into two tiers. You got the big studio films, the tent poles, whatever, and then you got what they call counter-programming by the dependents that offset big films. But back in 83 and, you know, and up until, I guess, till the late 80s, early 90s, when this finally started breaking off into a two-tier system, you just had films released in the summer that were just released. You know, one was for adults and some were for kids and then some were for the whole family. So what was it? What did it mean, or did it mean anything that, you know, this summer of, like, commercialism, you know, every summer, but you also got Fanning Alexander and Pauline at the Beach and Zelig. You got a Woody Allen film in the middle of summer. What did that mean? Did that mean anything back then?
Well, it didn't mean much of any. It didn't mean much of anything unless you could get to the city. That was the thing. I mean, people talk about counter-programming now. Mm-hmm. You know, Fanning Alexander, Pauline at the Beach, those pictures were not perceived as counter-programming. They were New York art house films,
mm-hmm.
and you either got in to see them, or you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I saw Pauline at the Beach. I didn't see Fanny and Alexander for a little while after that. I mean, for the multiplexes, counter-programming amounted to something like Strange Brew, the fabulous Doug and Bob McKenzie picture starring you know, Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas, and taking its plot points from Hamlet and actually containing a, you know, a Jedi reference. You know,
which,
come with me, Luke, I'm your father.
Yeah, those were all great moments.
I was going to bring that up in that Strange Brew. And oddly enough, it got announced this week that the animated series has been picked up by Fox with Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas reprising their roles, doing the voices for the animated show. Apparently, it's been a big hit on Canadian television.
As it should be.
What was it like seeing a Strange Brew movie? Because obviously, Blues Brothers had been spun off from Saturday Night Live, but there was none of this plethora of Saturday Night Live characters turning into movies. But here's Strange Brew that comes from SCTV.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the anticipation, or what was the curiosity when that got?
It was an entirely different kettle of fish, because the Blues Brothers fans had kind of gotten into the habit of taking the Blues Brothers seriously, to the extent that John Belushi would do these concerts with Dan Aykroyd and be kind of flummoxed by the fact that these guys in the audience were like, you know, taking their versions of the blues, and Belushi was appalled, actually. He would say, no, go buy the real records, you know. Whereas Doug and Bob McKenzie were, had the seeds of their own destruction implanted in the fact that they were only created by Moranis and Thomas by the fact that, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation demanded 2 minutes of indigenously Canadian content, so they just, as a supreme screw you to those guys, created these two toque-wearing, back-bacon-frying idiots who would sit there and talk about beer for, like, you know, the allotted percentage of the time, and then that took off and became some sort of a weird phenomenon. Everything that they did with those characters from that point on was reflective of the fact that it was just idiotic that people were picking up on them in the first place. So, you know, they make this sort of feature film that's based on the plot line of Hamlet. I mean, it's hyper, you know, it's metastasizing their mediocrity to a new level. And that was the basis of anticipation for the film. It wasn't like, wow, I love Doug and Bob McKenzie. It was more like, oh, geez, it's gotten this crazy and ridiculous, and where are they going to take it now? It was
even the trailer is subversive in
yeah.
The announcement.
It was one of the, you know, Doug and Bob McKenzie were, and I guess as they're being revived, a test remains one of the great media pranks of this and the last century.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this real quick. And then we were talking earlier in between segments about how I my theory was that in this 83 and these early 80s, we're seeing this kind of shift away from stars who were in the 70s, who were in their 30s and 40s,
mm-hmm.
De Niro, Pacino, Hoffman,
yeah.
All these guys. And so in these early 80s, we're really seeing the shift to youth-oriented stars in their 20s. And then obviously it's gotten younger and younger. But so I want to ask about a particular film. What was the reaction of something like Risky Business, which was we were being inundated with all these teenage sex comedies, and I'm sure
mm-hmm.
that's how Risky Business was sold. But then you go into Risky Business, and it's smarter.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the answer.
No, my friends and I, we saw Risky Business. It was clearly. What's the phrase that Godard uses? It was clearly a vrai film. It was a real film. You know, it had some real ideas, some real concerns, a real story, real witness screenplay. One of the interesting functions of the film was the presence of Tom Cruise, and we couldn't stand him. But that We felt that was actually the function of the character, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are coming, he wasn't Tom Cruise yet. So
was it because of other films, or just because he's too pretty and, you know, I don't like him right now?
We couldn't stand him. He was a prick. The character in the film was a prick, and also in the cut that, you know, Geffen insisted on making, he got away with it. The film, as a cinematic object that you sat through at that summer, was a good movie, but, you know, you didn't think the good guy got away with anything. You thought, Christ, what a frickin' world that this guy got away with this shit. It was the interpretation that you came away from the film with was entirely different from what it has since become. And the scene of him doing the Bob Seger song, Lip Sync in His Underwear, has become this iconic gesture of rebellion, whereas in the film, as if you were sitting in a theater and you had two-thirds of a brain and were watching it, it was just sort of, yeah, it's interesting how these, because of their cultural impact, the film's meaning actually tends to change. But believe me, if you were, a halfway smart film person watching this movie, and it was a good movie, but you were watching that scene and seeing Tom Cruise doing that, what you were thinking was not, whoa, what a cool guy. You were thinking like, whoa, what?
Yeah, and you weren't thinking, man, this is going to be a classic scene that will survive for 25 years.
You were
it's kind of embarrassing and silly.
Yeah, that's very true.
Its
actual function in the film is completely different from what it has since become.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We got to wrap it up because we're running behind. Our next guest is on the line, but
right.
Mr. Kinney, we think the world of your writing, sir. And Some Came Running is the name of your blog. And,
Some Came Running.
Typepad.com.
Thank you.
I recommend everyone go visit that. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure. And guys, continue this marathon. It sounds like a lot of fun.
It is fun. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Bye bye. That's Glenn Kinney, one of our great critical voices. We're 12 minutes. Our next guest has been on hold. I had to end it. I'm sorry, man.
Yes,
but I feel so bad. Our great friend, thehousenextdooronline.com, he has been collaborating with us for this concept, the summer of 83, all week. His contributors have been writing up essays on certain films for that summer, and here to tell us all about it is the man himself, Mr. Keith Ulick. Keith, are you with us?
Yes, hi guys. How are you?
Fine. Welcome back.
Hey, so Keith, were you listening to Glenn's rethink on Risky Business?
Yeah, I'm kind of alternately horrified and ecstatic that I've knocked Glenn off the phone and took over his place here. because we just had Glenn on a Grassroots Tavern podcast on The House Next Door, and it was so great that we had to break it up into three installments.
Yeah, the second installment went up today. I can't wait for the showdown, the smackdown, or whatever it's going to be between Glenn and Serena on Roman Polanski.
Yeah, it's not a smackdown per se, but it's kind of like it's both Roman Polanski and Sex in the City they talk about. So that still.
so tell our listeners. I want our listeners to know.
Yeah.
We made them aware of it Sunday. What you guys were doing for the essays and such for the summer of '83. If they go to your website now, thehousenextdooronline.com, what can they find relating to those films?
Yeah, well, first off, I should say I commissioned a lot more pieces, and I did not get as many as I hoped that I was going to get. So right now what we have is basically just an online discussion of Krull and another one of Staying Alive. And then today, I put up a whole, I basically went through the list that Aaron sent me of summer of 83 releases, and I went through like links online to different reviewers to see what reviews were of interest, and then I just did a big posting of like links.
That was great. I enjoyed those.
I was stunned when I read it. I was like, there's actually writing online about Puberty Blues?
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly enough.
Oh, there's something online about everything.
I guess
that's
true. And Mike Zaretsky doing Cujo, I was like, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a good write-up, too.
Yeah.
That was a good write-up.
And actually, I will say that over the next few days, I think we are going to have some of the latecomers come trickling in. I've heard from Matt Seitz that he's going to be doing a Zelig video essay that'll
Ooh.
Be up.
Oh, that should be interesting.
So I guess, you know, I was hoping we could get everything to be, like, promotional lead-in, but it looks like we're also going to have, like, post-podcast stuff.
Well, so
well.
In the days ahead, I urge our listeners, Jerry, if you could type it in the chat room,
the
web address, thehousenextdooronline.com, because terrific film writing every day on that site. It's a must-visit site every day. When you look through the list of films that were released in 83,
mm-hmm.
Keith, what strikes you about that list?
Well, first of all, personally, I should say I had wanted to contribute an essay too for Pauline at the Beach, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, actually. Mm. I unfortunately did not get to it before the podcast, just a lot of factors and stuff. But I might still get to it at some point. But I did sort of want to give a plug here because that's, I think, one of Romero's best movies. It's just absolutely beautiful. As far as general thoughts about the list, I mean, I was listening to the tail end of what Glenn was saying, and, you know, what he was saying was that things like the Romare and I guess like the, what was it called, the Greenaway film,
The Draftsman Contract?
Right. You know, weren't really counter-programming because they tended to play only in the cities. And I guess to an extent that's still true, but it does seem more and more now that you can get good copies of these films either via the internet or via DVD. So
mm-hmm.
in a sense, they are probably more widely available now, as long as you know what to do and how to do it. And
right,
right.
As far as where they were then, you know.
By that summer, summer had pretty much been defined as what we know of it today, hadn't it? I mean, Star Wars certainly changed the feeling on summer, which used to be a dumping ground for films. It became the time to release them if you wanted to make a buck.
Yeah.
Now, 83 fell into that, right?
Yeah, I also remember Matt saying to me once that he felt that one of the periods in American filmmaking that's usually defined as the 70s, you know, the great 70s renaissance, kind of ended in 83 with The Right Stuff for him. He felt like that was the last film that really sort of harkened back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say, but Matt's not a detractor of the 80s films, and really neither am I. I mean, you know, I think what looking at that list also showed was that there were a lot of beautiful things that were coming out around that time, and I think 83 also saw later in the year, or early in the year, L'Argent by Bresson, and Nostalgia by Tarkovsky. So, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's beautiful stuff there. I think the thing is, of course, with Spielberg and Lucas and all of them did, the main thing that changed was kind of like the release patterns and what got widely seen and the economics of the business and stuff, you know, and that created, you know, an atmosphere where for a lot of people when you were going through the shit, you saw mainly shit.
Something that was written today on the blog about Staying Alive, or yesterday, was that it was a bad movie, but not bad enough to enjoy as a guilty pleasure.
Right.
Amongst these titles we see, which some are just, you know, unmistakably bad, is there one for you that acts as a guilty pleasure from that summer?
Just thinking about it. You know, it's funny. I was looking at the list. I realized how much I hadn't seen, and you know, I've never seen Porky's 2 the next day. I haven't seen Stroker Ace. I think was in there somewhere. I think Smokey and the Bandit 3, for God's sake. I mean, you know, I can't think of anything in there that was like a guilty pleasure from that particular year.
Mm.
To be honest, yeah. I mean, what about you guys?
I got to go with Guilty, because I really don't like Staying
Alive. And I should also preface that by saying I don't believe in guilty pleasures personally, so, you know.
That's fine, Keith, that's fine.
I don't believe in them. I mean, I don't believe in them as on principle, But the fact is, there are films that are bad that we probably are afraid to admit that we've watched.
Yeah.
Multiple times.
Oh, I'm not afraid to admit anything, Aaron.
I ain't afraid either. And you know, like last night, I saw the Steve Coogan movie Hamlet 2. I mean, it's god awful, but it's so funny. The movie felt like it was beamed in from '83, '84. To be honest, aside from the references to Aaron Brockovich and everything in it, it felt like one of those comedies from the '80s. It's just like, what the fuck am I watching? Why am I laughing so hard at this piece of shit? But, you know.
To me, the underrated comedy of the summer of '83 is actually Jaws 3D.
You know what? Oh my God! There you go. That's it. That's for me too. Although my favorite of that series in that regard is Jaws of Revenge, which has
a memory.
where Lorraine Gray has flashbacks to events that she was not present in, but Jaws 3D. Jaws 3D is wonderful. Jamie can sort of attest to this because he lived near where they were filming it. But
really?
You gotta love Lou Gossett Jr. Yeah. You know, you're talking about some damn shark's mother is just one of the great lines.
You know what though? I'm wondering how much of Jaws 3D was actually an attempt to just be a 2-hour advertisement for their new shark attraction.
True.
Because
that's a very good point, Jamie.
Well, of course.
I mean, that had to have been on the agenda, you know. And so even from that perspective, it has some cultish value.
I'd like to chime in, though, with some. I saw three films that summer that were released a long time ago, but we used to have revival houses around here. And we went to go see a new print of The Hidden Fortress and Grand Illusion and The Rules of the Game. And we didn't get to do that. Although my mom took us to a double feature of Grand Illusion and Rules of the Game and took us out to lunch, which was unheard of, and before or after. But it was just it was a great time. You know, I was only like, I think I was only 12, but those are incredible things to see at that age.
There's a lot of reading.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I'm amazed actually. That's great.
It is something to say that I got to give a hat tip to the SeaWorld people in that. I'm sure they saw the script, and this shark is going to be eating patrons, but they seem to have the greater vision in that, okay, people are going to know it's a movie, so we don't mind that you're going to have a shark eating our customers, because we're going to have to showcase our other attractions at this SeaWorld.
Well, essentially, that's what the shark, you know, I don't know how I became a spokesperson for SeaWorld, but that's what that shark attraction was. It's almost like, we dare you to walk through this, you know, and you're going to be closer to sharks than ever before. So I think it might have worked out. I don't know. I'd been to SeaWorld before I saw Jaws 3D, so I can't really attest to that.
And of course,
did shark try to attack you?
No. And now I'm starting to think that maybe Jaws 3D is like a sort of quote satire on corporate greed or something.
Yeah.
It would be something. In fairness to Jaws, it would be something to see it, quote unquote, restored, remastered, and see it in a proper new, you know, the new 3D technology, and see what do they really have if they have anything.
Well, I think I've seen it letterboxed. It seems pretty inept to me, but you know,
I saw it in 3D.
You're right.
I saw it in 3D actually. And as a 10-year-old seeing it in 3D, I mean, it was cool, but it worked actually. But you're talking about inept. It's just that they have to devise some shots that work for 3D that play so ridiculous and unmotivated in a regular format. Mm-hmm. You know, you hold on a severed fish head as it comes closer and closer to you for about a full minute. I mean, in a regular format, I mean, that just plays, what the hell are you doing? Don't you know how to cut?
That's very Bellatar. Maybe Bellatar saw this film and got inspired.
Well, and I was thinking, actually, with all the negative reviews it's been getting, it seems like the happening of its day, but, you know.
That you may have a very good point there, Keith. I think you're on to something.
Let me ask you this, Keith. Have you seen the remake of Breathless? We were talking about it with Glenn, the Jim McBride remake of the Godard classic.
I have not, and, you know, I mean, I guess I just think that Gere already sort of went to that well with his Pickpocket remake with American Gigolo, but you know,
that's very good.
And I mean, I think American Gigolo is like one of the best movies ever. So, you know.
Do you really?
I love American Gigolo.
Oh, it's a good. I watched it earlier this year. It's a very good
Gigolo
film.
Is amazing.
American Gigolo and Mishima are like my two favorite Schrader movies.
I know you did something on Schrader on your blog a couple of days ago, like a video clip of him. Were you able to hear our Schrader interview?
Yeah. No, that was terrific. And
where he said the film was dead.
I know. I mean, he's kind of a blowhard in a lot of ways, but you know.
I love that about him, though. I love that because he made that statement. We had a record number of people listen to that show.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's,
God love him.
Yeah.
And I actually just got the Criterion Mishima disc, so I'm going to be reviewing that at some point in the near future.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. And it has the Roy Scheider narration. What's also nice is that I think he always intended it to be all in Japanese. At least that's what it defaults to on the disc, so I'm presuming that's the director's choice. So now you get to hear Ken Ogata's narration, over everything as well. And it's actually subtitled in time with his dialogue, which is nice. It wasn't like that on the original DVD. So,
right.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'll tell that actually... we need to talk to Kevin Lee again, who did that Schrader thing, and that we were possibly thinking about doing something on Light Sleeper, which I think is actually an underrated Schrader film, and that is actually
a
companion piece to both Gigolo and a kind of a rejoinder to the final scene of Taxi Driver.
I want to, just to close this off, I have a little montage that I've made. And it's probably going to be the highlight of the show. it's going to take us back. A little 5-minute montage. It's not comprehensive because there's obviously a great many movies that came out that summer. But it gives you a taste of some of the joys of that summer.
Right.
If we can listen to this and then just quick comments on it afterwards, and then we'll close it out. This should be fun. Here's our 1983 montage from that summer.
Who's that? What you want?
Police. We've had some complaints about con men pretending to be blind and crippled.
Oh, I'd love to help you, man, but I ain't seen nothing since I stepped on that landmine in Viet Cong back in 72. It was rough. That was painful.
You were in Nam? So were we. Where?
I was in Sang Bang, Dangan. I was all over that place, basically. A lot of places.
What unit were you in?
I was with the Green Beret, Special Unit Battalion, Commando Airborne Tactics, Specialist Tactics, Unit Battalion. Yeah, it was real hush-hush. I was Agent Orange, that was my name, Agent Orange, Special Agent Orange, that was me.
Airborne, huh?
I can see! I have legs! Oh, shit, look at this! Man, I can walk, Jesus! Praise Jesus!
Good. Use your aggressive feelings, boy. Let the heat flow through you.
Obi-Wan has taught you well.
I will not fight you.
You are unwise to lower your defenses.
Did you ever watch The Twilight Zone? Oh, God. Remember The Twilight Zone with Burgess Meredith? Remember, he loved to read, and there was a nuclear war, and he had no friends anyway, and he was down on the base of glasses. The library. Yes, he was the last man. He broke his glasses. Yeah. This thing freaked me out. When I was 7 years old, I bought another pair of glasses just in case that would happen. Oh, those shows. Hey, you want to see something really scary? You bet.
Academy Award winner Lou Gossett Jr. takes you underwater on the trail of the Great White One and behind the scenes of the latest Jaws movie. Don't miss this television special, which unleashes a whole new dimension of thrills. The making of Jaws 3D. Sharks don't die.
He didn't die. I ask you to kill Superman, and you're telling me you couldn't even do that one simple thing.
All right, Webster, the game's over.
But only the man who pulled the switch on Superman.
Oh, see, I'm not with them, Superman.
You're gonna fool me, mister.
Can pull the plug on Super Machine.
You're going to go down in history as the man who killed Superman.
No.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Meet Dad. He's a real man.
Got a beer?
7 o'clock in the morning.
Scotch?
An all-out go-getter. But when his job pulled the plug on him...
I'm fired?
You son of a bitch!
They threw a switch.
Go, finally. Good luck.
And he became the lady of the house. Mr. Mom, a mother of a comedy.
Jeffrey is 4 years old. I know that because Jeffrey kept walking around the plane. Just anybody, I'm 4 years old. I'm four years old. I was 3, but now I'm 4 years old. Little Jeffrey. I remember his name not because he said to me, I'm 4 years old, but because Jeffrey's mother said his name all 2,500 miles of the trip. Nobody on first class could sleep because the woman, Jeffrey, will you get down? Jeffrey, don't do that. Jeffrey, come over here. Oh, look at what you've done, Jeffrey. You kicked him. Jeffrey, will you please, Jeffrey, put your jacket. Don't do that, Jeffrey. Jeffrey. And Jeffrey would stand up in the chair and look at the little man behind him. I thought you saw.
There's a little montage of some highlights.
That was
that
great.
Stuff.
That was a very good choices there.
You know, even the bad movies, though.
Yeah, I mean the bad ones.
It takes you back to a time when, I mean, it just feels so innocent back then. And the rustic nature of how they're trailer, that's definitely been an art form that's been perfected, the art form of putting together a trailer, especially when you look back at some of those old ones from the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Trailers have gotten much better, except for Robert Zemeckis. But other than that, trailers have improved. And it is true, sharks do not die.
And I think I can absolutely say, Jamie, that was a mother of a montage.
Yes, that really was.
How did they get away with that, the mother of all comedies? And I thought it was funny. It was completely inadvertent how it cut together. You want to see something real scary, and then the Jaws 3. The Jaws 3.
That was good. It was very good.
I don't think people really, back then, the trailers, I mean, because trailers were like, minimum 2 minutes long. And unlike nowadays where, you know, you have commercials and so forth, and so people are really getting to these theaters early, you know, back then, you know, it was I remember my parents telling me, you know, they would go to the movies and whatever was, like, in mid-film, and then you could sit through the next show until the part you came in on. So I think, you know, a lot of people, if they ever saw these trailers, I think they were too busy getting, you know, situated actually here.
That's just it. Going back through these old trailers, man, it goes back to your Zemeckis complaint. They showed everything. I mean, the Superman 3 trailer, it showed you the entire movie beat for beat from start to finish. There was no question what happened in any part of that movie. It's like for people that want to absolutely 100% know what they're walking into before they buy it.
I think the best trailer, the ones that I saw from this summer, actually, I thought the best trailer was actually the Psycho 2 trailer, because there they just showed you the shower scene, and then they showed Anthony Perkins walking into the house, and they said Norman has come home, and that was it. They didn't show you any new footage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Psycho 2 trailer, even though it's a little long and that they show you the whole shower scene, I think that was actually probably the best trailer.
I think so too. I mean, that goes back to my all-time favorite trailer, which is for Polanski's The Tenant.
Mm-hmm.
The original teaser that just showed his face, and it said, "No one does it to you like Polanski." And then it ended. Oh my God, I got to see that. I hadn't seen a frame of the movie, but I had to go see it.
Yeah.
Keith, what memories come back for you listening to that?
How old were you, Keith, in the summer of '83? Were you
in
born?
80? Oh yeah, I was born. I was born in '77. I was 6, or about to turn 6, because my birthday is July 13th, and.
So you're a year older than me. Okay.
Yeah. Well, there you go. But though it's funny though. I mean, you know, Actually, hearing all that reminds me of how many movies I did not see in the theater in 83. As a matter of fact, I don't think I saw any of them. You know, but 83 is a very important year for me because the first video I ever rented was Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's kind of like 83 is probably marked as the year from which I first began renting videotapes. As a matter of fact, now that I'm thinking about it, the first R-rated movie I ever rented was National Lampoon's Vacation. So,
mm-hmm.
There you go. And I mean, I just because of who I am and looking at, you know,
right.
patterns, numbers, I mean, it's like, you know, I was born in the year of Star Wars and kind of, but the first year that I'm really cognizant of, like, renting movies from and probably reconstructing the year in is 83, when Jedi
mm-hmm.
comes out. So, I mean, you know, Star Wars to Jedi is kind of like, you know, a developmental period for me, I guess, albeit in retrospect, you know. And
also you bring up an important point, which is the importance of home video during that time, because it exposed us to a lot of movies, and they grow in stature as a result. And I think a prime example of that doesn't come from that summer, but rather that year. We're seeing the cult classic of all that keeps surviving and thriving is Scarface, and that was
right.
that was
yeah.
December
yeah.
of that year. Something
yeah.
that only grows more and more in stature as the
yeah,
years go by.
That's
a
true.
Film that was reviled by critics.
Yeah.
It made money, but at the it was one of those films that made money, but at the time people went, but I think they came out either bewildered or totally offended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't
that's
until
true.
You know, years later that you know they really got into it. I guess after you know Miami Vice helped it. The one point I want to make, and I've made this a couple of times. I even posted a comment on it. I want to see what you think, Keith, in that. For me, this first summer is laying the groundwork for really the explosion, and it's popular already at this time, but really the explosion of HBO the following year, because that's when these films, in like I guess in the spring and summer of 84, is when these films go into heavy rotation on HBO, so
yeah.
that, you know, if you were 7 in 84, that's all you really did, because you couldn't go to the movies when you wanted to. You had to go when your parents took you.
Right.
But if you had HBO, you caught up with everything, and because they constantly showed it, you saw Crawl. It didn't even matter if you liked or disliked Crawl. Crawl was on. So
it was
watched,
on. Yeah.
You watched
that,
it.
That's
yeah,
very true.
Except I have to talk from my yeah. perspective. My parents were very much restrictive on television, and
mm-hmm.
part of that was that they did not get HBO. As a matter of fact, I don't believe we ever had HBO until I was in college.
Oh, you poor
wow.
guy.
So that was not. No, but you see, but for whatever reason, I think that honestly might have contributed to me when I was 7, saying we have to rent some Akira Kurosawa movies. You know,
mm-hmm.
so it was sort of like I went in this different direction. Probably the reason that Kurosawa was so big for me was that there was this theater in my hometown. In 86, so I was actually older than 7, I was probably 9 or 10, but it had a marquee on which they had Ron, and I think the theater just was closed, but it still had Ron on the marquee, like forever, even after that, so that sort of made an impression on me, so it's sort of like I didn't really grow up with HBO, I grew up with HBO as kind of like a tantalizing thing, you know, that I could not experience, which is probably why now I'm reluctant to get rid of it now that I have it. Yeah,
right.
You missed out on all those real
like catching up with lost time, you
yeah.
know, and
yeah.
And of course, you know, like when Dream On was on, and I kept hearing about Dream On, and I was like, I don't care.
I remember that.
Oh, Mom,
I remember
Dad,
that. Yeah.
Mom, Dad, why can't we get HBO? It's like, no, Keith, you only have hours of TV every day, and this, that, and the other thing. But then they bought me a Nintendo system, so I certainly grew up with that.
I feel I'll throw this out there.
HBO was like a holy grail for me, you know, that I
yeah. I was the same way. We didn't get cable for a long time, so
I'll throw this out there, Keith. We are, and
yeah.
I think I mentioned it in my comment, is that I think there is a blog-a-thon to be done on HBO as a formative experience for
yeah.
our generation. Of, you know, even when you finally got it, it's a formative experience. But for those of us who had it as kids, I think there is a blog-a-thon to be done of what HBO means. That and my other idea, and if anyone is listening to this, they can steal it. If HBO executives are listening to this, they have
yeah.
so many HBO channels out there, which is fine, HBO Comedy, HBO Zone, you can
yeah.
do whatever you want. I feel the one untapped thing they need to do, because retro is the new thing right now, and it's never going away, a channel called HBO Nostalgia, where they show the actual programming from certain years. Like, if the July that we're about to get into, this coming up July, is the same July of, like, 1984, then show the 1984 programming. And you just alternate different months from different years. I think HBO Retro, as I would call it, would be – I don't think they realize how big a hit that would be.
Well, and you see, I'd actually like to take it one sort of avant-garde step further, and I'd want them to broadcast in the original quality, meaning that they do pan and scan and everything.
Right.
Well, I agree. To a degree, but, I mean, just, like, you know, have, like, the beat-up, crappiest prints and everything. And
I agree. The pan and scan – the 20 minutes of commercial that they would do in between films, and bring back, you know, bring back Fraggle Rock if you want to go, you know, bring all that back.
And because
I'm all for a 24-hour day Pong channel where you just see people play Pong all day.
Well, I think it was Michael Atkinson actually who wrote about remembering Pan and Scan movies more fondly than he did them in their original aspect ratios. You know, so there's probably even something to tap into there, although I'm very much now an aspect ratio purist. So I probably would only check into HBO Nostalgia out of, like, you know, pure, like, curiosity for, like, a few minutes, and then, like, say, nope, gotta – well, like I do with all the other HBO channels. Kind of right now, but, you know, I guess how many times am I going to watch Georgia Rule, but, you know, I mean
– Right.
Well, apparently, sorry.
I'm sorry. The website is thehousenextdooronline.com. Buddy, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I'm sorry you had to wait to come on, but you know, you have an open door policy.
Yeah.
Anytime you want to come on, just give us a call.
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Give us a call.
I will do that.
Thank you, buddy.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, gentlemen, Summer of 83 is 2 hours and 40 minutes, and it's time to wrap it up.
It's almost as long as Fanny and Alexander, just to keep it going.
That's right. That's what I was aiming for.
Yeah, we're getting there.
And hopefully more entertaining than a Bergman film, but who knows. Sunday we'll be back. Jerry, Chris, and myself, and we'll be causing mayhem and trouble, I'm sure.
That's right. We'll be causing lots of trouble.
So stay tuned to the blog postings. Thanks so much, everyone out there, for your patience and your listenership. We appreciate it. You're our family. Never forget that.
Yeah.
Any suggestions you have, send them our way through MySpace. And I hope you guys had a good nostalgic trip down memory lane tonight to the summer of 83.
Excellent job, Jamie.
Thank you, Aaron and Jerry.
Thank you.
So much. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormack, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.